And we are live. This is Dark Journalist. It's fantastic to have so many of you here. Welcome to our special Saturday night segment of the X series that's going to be dealing with the Fourth Way and P.D. Ouspensky in the system of man's possible development and the kind of humanity's evolution, which is something that he was very much after. Right off the bat, I want to say that last night's episode that we did with Walter Bosley on the secret space program and all the breaking developments and all appears to be caught in a time warp in that YouTube is still processing it almost about 24 hours later. So
I am not hopeful about it.
Yeah, it was very mysterious. And a lot of people have been telling me that the video is kind of playing peekaboo. You know, it's there sometimes and it's not there. It's kind of like the Philadelphia experiment. So we got a little apothium in the system on last night's video. But interestingly enough, you can search for it if you just search Dark Journalist and the X series XXXI. It's there without the first 40 minutes. So it's a couple
Which
hours.
Which I have to there. Say, we're the best part of the video.
It's all quite good. But, you know, the thing is, it does feel rather incomplete without the first 40 minutes. So there's a lot of weirdness there, and we're working with YouTube to get it resolved. So that's the big update there. It's odd, and we've noticed things have been pretty odd around social media in the last week, shall we say, getting more and more reports along that line, but we're powering on through in any case. Of course, we're joined by the lovely Olivia.
Hi, everybody.
And I want to remind everyone right off the bat that we are doing a special Halloween show on Wednesday night. Of course, we do the X series every Friday night at 7 p.m. And we'll be back next Friday, of course. But Wednesday night is a Halloween special with Gigi Young. And we're going over the CERN Tarot, which is a very interesting learning investigation that I've been doing with Gigi. And she's come up with some remarkable things. And as I understand it, she's going to come in costume, and I'll try to do my best as well. What did she say? She's going to be dressed like a grape?
Yeah, a bunch of grapes.
You know, Gigi's got the imagination. And so we're doing that Wednesday night at 7 p.m. So everyone join us. If you're not out trick-or-treating, certainly tune in on Wednesday for that very special show on this. I've been waiting to do that on the CERN Tarot. There's a couple of...
Should we let them know about the special surprise we have about the CERN Tarot?
Yeah, well, we're going to get into all that.
Okay.
We are going to get into all that, absolutely. And it's going to be quite special. But I have to say that there's going to be a lot of surprises on Wednesday night, put it that way. Mm-hmm. Now, a couple of things I want to do is a little bit of kind of housekeeping. Since yesterday, there was a big story as we were coming live at that point, and it was that the Corey Goodsphere Being Alliance had decided to give up the hunt for the trademark for the SSP secret space program. And, you know, it's interesting because we had done a week of this no SSP TM thing, which really united the community against this reckless effort to start trademarking names. We went into what a copyright troll is and how if somebody gets intellectual property around these very important alternative research subjects, that it can be a disaster, really, because they can actually turn around and sell it to a larger corporation. And even if, whether they like it or not, that corporation can lock up that research. So we went into good detail about that last night. And I think what's important to point out is a number of things happened that were great. You know, it's that effect, really, when you have a number of people in the community and they know each other, but they don't work together that much, you know. And, you know, like a drug dealer moves into the community and everybody gets alerted to it. And everyone comes out of their house and they're shaking hands and getting to know each other a little bit better. And certainly that was the case with a lot of the alternative research community on this. The no SSPTM was answered ultimately by Corey Good and the Sphere Being Alliance, saying that they were going to stop this trademark search. But I noticed a few odd things about that. I'm very happy that that's happened, and you know, we've acknowledged that that's a good thing. But a couple of things in the aftermath of that I think are quite interesting, which is that they still are sending out little proxies to go after this issue and claim that they never tried to trademark it in the first place. So just without any, you know, without me saying it or without you, you know, just go right to the USPTO.gov office. It is there. Right now, the trademark, just before they went ahead and said they're not going to do it anymore, there had been objections to it, 802 objections, meaning someone was objecting legally to the trademark, and they were requesting an extension of time to file opposition. Okay, that was the state of it there. And, you know, there's no getting around it. I mean, it's there. Anybody can search it. I don't know why anybody would be idiotic enough to say that's not what we were trying to do. This is another one where they said, well, no, it was just SSP. It had nothing to do with the Secret Space Program. First of all, you know, let's get real. The Secret Space Program is what SSP is. But just in case anybody had any doubts, I want to point this one out so everyone's clear. This is Corey Good's trademark application, okay? This says here, the mark is Secret Space Program, okay? It's unmistakable. So when you hear people say, well, they weren't trying to do it or it was something else and, you know, blah, blah, blah. No, I mean, they were trying to do it. There's no weaseling out of it after the fact. It's nice that they gave up trying to do it. They were going to have to give it up anyway because there was already a motion in place, but who wants to go through all that? So that was a win-win. Coming out the next day and sniping around at everybody, and then this ridiculous thing in the statement saying that, you know, they were going to do this premiere, but now because there's infiltrators, you know, there's going to be like some kind of a terror strike against their movie, you know, making all the researchers in the community their enemy. And it's ridiculous. So it's this kind of rhetoric that we continually see out of that group. And, you know, if they don't give up the rhetoric and nobody's buying it, now, I can tell you this from having worked on this last year, having put together a series called The New Age Deep State on this group and their cult-like bullying activities in the community, you know, they had a lot more members. They had a lot more people on the ground than they did this time. If anything, their support is waning. And if they keep this up, it's just going to dry up completely. So, you know, be my guest. But, you know, I think for the sake of sanity, let's get two things very clear. The SSP, Secret Space Program, trademark was attempted by Corey Good and the Sphere Being Alliance. And they did come forward yesterday to say that they weren't going to do that. And while they were saying that, of course, they knew there was a legal action pending against the trademark. So fine, it was the right thing to do. Good. Two, he says clearly in his statement that they weren't trying to trademark the Secret Space Program, which on its face is absolutely absurd. And I spend a lot of time, you know, when people try to get into trademarks around the Secret Space Program, I watch it very, very closely. And as I've promised on this program, I will continue to watch it very closely because the Secret Space Program is at the very heart of the X steganography because it applies to all the secret programs that go X and then go underground. So, of course, we're going to keep an eye on it. And you had the best people on it, like Catherine Austin Fitz, Richard Dolan, Cliff High, and a plethora of people from the alternative research community. And the next day, you know, you start seeing these comments from the proxies of the Corey camp saying, well, you know, Fitz is a shill or Dolan is in with so-and-so, you know, I mean, just nonsense. So just knock it off. You know, you overreached and it was enough. The community stood up and stood up against you. And that dumb idea, I don't know who gave it to you. It was a terrible idea. And you did the right thing. Just leave it there. You know, there is no proxies and there's nobody trying to infiltrate your movie. You know, it's a silly movie anyway. Okay.
Right. We've seen it all before.
We've seen it all before. It looks like a tame episode of Ancient Aliens. Okay. And if you want to spend your time doing that, be my guest. But, you know, I want to get real on the language because if you guys feel, you know, like you have to throw that kind of language around when you're dealing with people in the alternative research community, then you're doing something wrong, frankly. And a lot of people who are in the community are noticing it more now than ever. But I wanted to clarify that because we had that in the episode last night. That's what's in those first 40 minutes that got clipped. On a good note, you know, there are people who have been known to work around the Sphere Being Alliance, like Teresa Yaneros, who stood up and were very independent, saying that they, you know, know SSPTM. And she tweeted that out and showed a lot of bravery. And I've saluted her on this program a couple of times now because of that. And, you know, there can be no greater pressure than when you're working, at least around a group. I mean, she does so much stuff independently anyway. So, you know, she's hardly just associated with them, but having done some things with them, for her to come forward and say that, I think was was remarkable, and it's one of those great
things to see. It was, and we should give her credit because they have proven themselves to be a bunch of bullies, particularly around women who don't necessarily have protection and using social media and gaslighting. Let's just not mince words about it.
Yeah, I think it's right. That's absolutely right. I've noticed this. I don't understand, and I'm going to go into this more with Gigi Young, but there is something in relation to women around this community where the men just feel like they can bully and bulldoze around the alternative research community, when in fact, women have a natural built-in advantage when dealing with these topics. You know, they're used to complex thinking, they're used to heart-centered thinking, they know how to go deep on it. So they should actually be the best leaders, I would say, when it comes to the independent media. So let's keep that in mind.
Yeah, well, I've said it before and I'll say it again, is that the New Age community, which is largely populated by women, gentle women, kind-hearted women, it takes one to know one. And so it's very hard to see a wolf dressed in sheep's clothing until it's too late. And I think there's a lot of that going on here.
Well, a lot of people have been on wolf patrol, shall we say, and there's no question about that. Yeah, I think we're going to see more. We're going to see more of the women in the community coming out against this kind of thing. And I think they're going to discover a lot of natural allies when they do that. But I am impressed that the alternative research group as a whole kind of was a community with one voice during this, because we cannot allow copyright trolls, trademark shills, any of that stuff to come in here as proxies for corporations to try to take terms that are part of our research lexicon and trademark them basically out of existence. That, you know, won't stand in any case. But I am glad that this one was resolved this way, and that the goods group decided that they weren't going to pursue it. So, you know, take them at their word, the proxy action notwithstanding. Okay, so now we've dealt with that, and of course we'll continue to keep a close eye on it and continue to report on it for you, so you know that everything is safely done, like when they legally remove the trademark in the USPTO.gov system. Okay, fantastic. And one other thing I want to point out, which is that we have a fantastic, and I mean fantastic, November coming up for you with Catherine Austin Fitz, Joseph Farrell, and we're trying to schedule Richard Dolan, and so we're talking on that. So it might be just absolute firecracker month here at Dark Journalist. All right, so Miss Olivia, was there anything else on that?
I just want to say Cliff High is in the chat.
Okay, great.
And it's great to see you. And I caught a little of your sort of Eastern philosophy class today, and it was great.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
So needed. Thank you so much.
Right. Well, Cliff is that guy. He's very eclectic, a lot of knowledge base, you know, philosophy, Bitcoin, you name it. He's got it. So we were listening to that in our coffee drive, as mm-hmm. I call it today. It was great stuff. And we have a fantastic crowd out there. Thank you so much. And this is an unusual Saturday night broadcast, because we usually are broadcasting on Friday nights at 7 p.m. But tonight I wanted to get back into a full-fledged X show without all of the trappings of the trademark stuff that's been going on, the trademark party, as they say, and get into the character of Peter Ouspensky, P.D. Ouspensky, who was a Russian philosopher and had an incredible impact on how we think about mystery schools, and had that kind of close-up experience where he put himself right in the middle of a very dynamic situation, working with someone in G.I. Gurdjieff, who came right out of the mystery schools and was setting up there at the time in Moscow. And what's fascinating is that Ouspensky was a seeker his whole life. He had a number of difficulties, and he's mostly known for teaching the Gurdjieff system and giving us the fourth way, which is the name of the system. What's interesting about it is that he was a very established writer before that, including works of fiction. And I always love pointing this out about Ouspensky. Let's get a good look at this guy who was an incredibly deep thinker and one of the best, I think, intellectuals that we've ever had, went much deeper than you know, traditional philosophers, was very into esoteric, and actually was a member of the Theosophical Society for many years before he met up with Gurdjieff. they had come along around this period where in the First World War was breaking out. So Theosophy had already gone through a number of wild changes, and Blavatsky was gone, and there was this whole controversy with Krishnamurti and the World Teacher. So Theosophy was really on the wane, and it had outspent its welcome. It had become, you know, coming from this aspect where, you know, Blavatsky had brought forward these ascended masters that she had dealt with and was giving this incredible wisdom, which was highly valuable and came as a direct response to the scientific materialism of the day around 1870, 1875. So when we came forward with Isis Unveiled through Blavatsky, it was quite interesting because those esoteric truths had lay dormant pretty much since Pythagoras. And so they rocked the world back there. Nobody knew where did she get access to all this information and all this knowledge. So we were coming out of this and the kind of wave of spiritualism that had swept in America and across Europe. And these things were engineered by the mystery schools as a direct response, some of them very reluctantly because they didn't want these secrets to get out to the general population. And there are different types of mystery schools, but I would say in this case, the mystery schools were not kind of obscuring things for their own benefit, and that they were helping humanity evolve at a certain stage, and they were letting information out about the deep mysteries. And there was a kind of a motto about the mystery schools, which was that if you wanted to learn it, you'd have to earn it. So it wasn't going to be given to you. It was going to be something you had earned and acquired. That very much gets to the philosophy that Gurdjieff came out with. So in a way, the Uspensky-Gurdjieff fourth way system comes more into kind of a work for it system. And it's a little less cosmic in that sense, I guess you could say. We do have incredible cosmic aspects to it, you know, but it's, whereas Theosophy is really training someone about their astral body and their ethereal body and chakras and, you know, this incredible knowledge from the East. With Gurdjieff's system, it was all about what your body's doing, what your personality is doing, and how out of control your machine is. He'd refer to the human body as a sleeping machine and how we had to wake up the operator of the machine, one, and two, we had to fix the machine from all the problems that it had. Now, it's quite interesting because, of course, this was the industrialization was sweeping in. Things were getting more mechanized. But oddly enough, like so many of the things that happen in the space of the mystery schools coming forward, like with Rudolf Steiner's movement, and with Blavatsky's movement, and Besant with Theosophy, you know, so much of it is really coming true now. And this was kind of the setup in our psyche to help us get the foundation that we needed in order to handicap the situation in the 21st century. Now, what I think is also interesting to point out here is that these movements all have an element of prediction or recurrence to them. That is, they're saying, we're doing this now, but in this period of time, this is all going to come back and you're going to have another opportunity to use all the tools we're giving you here. I find that interesting. You'll find it in Theosophy. You'll find it in Anthroposophy. You'll find it. Steiner directly made the prediction in 1916 that in a 100-year period, from 1916, there was going to be a 20 to 30 year window where we were going to have the ability to move forward with the knowledge of the mystery schools. The opportunity would come up again if they failed there during that period in World War I. And by all accounts, Steiner had thought that they had failed. Another person who thought that they were failing was Uspensky. And Uspensky was very interesting because he was a journalist. He was working for these different newspapers in Moscow, and he had also gone on trips around the world, and he was writing back and doing these columns, and it was all about seeking out higher truths, and what he was looking for directly was the mystery schools, but he didn't tell the newspaper that. He kind of just threw it in and said, yeah, I'm going to go hang out with yogis, and I'm going to go to India, I'm going to do all this stuff, and I'll write the stories for you guys. But his true quest was to find these higher knowledge schools that had been kept in this mystery tradition where he could get higher knowledge, because he felt that our day-to-day lives, we had lost this connection with something very important, and that our perceptions had become dull and that we needed to get back there and find it. And that it was especially important now that we were in this kind of brutal world of the early 20th century. So when he came back, people, just to put this in a nutshell, introduced him to Gurdjieff, who was also in Russia teaching this philosophy of the fourth way, but he was a Greek Armenian, and he had worked with all of these deep, deep mystery schools in Asia and in Egypt. And the brotherhood that he came from was called the Sarmoon Brotherhood, and Sarmoon translated ultimately meant beekeepers, or they keep the honey. So this idea of holding a tradition for mankind, for humanity's purpose, bringing it forward, and really moving it kind of underground so that it wasn't going to get persecuted, was very key to his story. And Gurdjieff is very much a mysterious character, because there's no doubt he came out of a mystery school, but at a certain point, it seems like he became his own operation. And it's kind of startling, the difference between when he's first working with Uspensky versus, say, 10 years later, when it seems like so many of those rules have gone out the window. So there's been a lot of conjecture about that. And we're going to get into exactly what their relationship was, because, you know, it seems like, in essence, Gurdjieff, being a master from one of these mystery schools, had this great impression on Uspensky, but Uspensky also had a great sense of truth and seeking. And when he saw things go awry with Gurdjieff, he parted company, but he continued to teach his system, which is called the Fourth Way System. And I want to kind of get a few quotes from Uspensky about what the system is and why it's important. Someone has sketched out some notes and taken them from certain, there's a book called The Fourth Way, which is basically just a bunch of exchanges of students asking Uspensky questions. And it's quite a remarkable book. I always recommend it. And it can be sometimes hard to follow, but it's remarkable, I think, the kind of impact that he was having working with these people directly. And there was something in the system where you had to work with people. That is, to go off on your own and study these things and to kind of ascend on your own was not the way. The fourth way was about working with groups. So let's just take a quick look at this. This is a quote about the system. And Uspensky said, relating to it, that the system cannot be learned from books. If it could, there would be no need for schools. I think that's very important. There are levels when we talk about mystery schools, I've discovered over time in analyzing it. You know, people say, well, where are the mystery schools now? And the thing is, you don't find them, but you do find their influence and their footprints and their fingerprints. But the, you know, the kind of public schools, you could say, from the mystery schools, there's a whole kind of hierarchy of how that works. And it comes down to, you know, public study groups are out there. There are private study groups is maybe kind of a greater level of information. You have arcane schools, and then you have what they call lesser schools. And then you get into something called mystery schools, which, you know, they're very life-changing when you're a part of them. And there have been groups like the Rosicrucians and Hermetic groups that have kept these types of traditions over time. And they're certainly very active now. So this is kind of a crucial thing as a fundamental for the X series when we get into it, because the X series is a search for the X-steganography that links the modern secrecy around X-technology and that advanced technology, the UFO file, to the mystery schools and how they were hiding these truths and saving them for humanity. Miss Olivia.
Could you go into, if it can't be taught from a book, how this would differ from having a guru, if how much of it is about having the message be given to you specifically, the ones that you need with your specific spiritual development and weaknesses, and how much of it has to do with exercises, and how much of it has to do with relating to others within the group, sort of group dynamics?
Well, I think it's just the opposite of a guru situation. So like books, essentially what they're saying is you can learn enough information intellectually that will gather to you a kind of a magnetic center for certain ideas. So they're not discouraging books, but they're saying you can't learn a really advanced system like the Fourth Way from a book because it's experiential. In terms of how you're going to get there, they've given a lot of hints in the material, and I am going to get to them here. Now, he wrote, as I said, in the beginning, instead of writing books that were about philosophy and about the Fourth Way, before he met Gurdjieff, he wrote a few books that were fascinating. One of them is called The Strange Life of Ivan Ossakin. He's a very interesting character, and the setup is kind of like Groundhog Day, which is one of Olivia's favorites. am I right? Mm-hmm. What's your favorite? It's Bill Murray, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, and he's a news reporter, and he keeps living the same day over and over again. So, and he gets the opportunity to change things, but nothing happens. He keeps waking up inside the same day over and over again. With Ossakin, it's very similar. He gets to a point in his life where he makes all these different mistakes, and he's actually fairly young, around in his late 20s, by the time he decides he's going to commit suicide. And he goes into this mysterious magician's store to buy a gun to do it. And the magician instead gives him this formula for being able to go back and fix all the things in his life. And what happens is, the theory eventually is known as eternal recurrence. And there's that recurrence theme again that the mystery schools love to dole out there. They show up, the mystery schools, they make an impact on society, they withdraw for a while, and then they recur at some point in the future. This is the nature of their progression. So it's something important to keep in mind when we're talking about the X series. Because when we talk about groups like Anthroposophy and Theosophy, their wave, you can feel it more and more, is more applicable to the situation that we're in now. And their 100-year prediction is very obviously coming true. But going back to The Strange Life of Ivan Ossakin, this book where this guy keeps recurring this life, what he realizes when the magician sends him back is that, hey, I'm back here. I'm 15. I can make all those different choices and I'll change everything and my life will go much better than it did. Because he made a lot of stupid choices early on. He gets thrown out of school. He becomes a soldier and then he saves money and then he blows it all on a roulette wheel. And, this woman he was going to marry winds up marrying somebody else. And his whole life goes down the drain to the point where he's going to bump himself off. Now, interestingly enough, Ossakin, when he discovers the magician, the magician says, the only thing I want you to know before I send you back is that, you're kind of obsessed with this idea that you can go back and change everything, but you actually can't. You can't go back and change any of it, but you can try. And Ossakin says, well, I want to go back and change it, so I'm going to do it. So he goes back, and he wakes up and he's 15, and he starts to remember the whole scenario of the magician sending him back and his whole life and how it unfolded. But as he's there, weeks and weeks, it starts to slip away, basically. And there's no memory of, there's little distant voices and dreams about the magician and his former life. And when he meets people, there's a weird deja vu that happens. But as it turns out, he starts to go into these situations and he has that little tingling memory that this is what you did wrong that screwed everything up last time. And as he goes to change the outcome, he can't. There's an overpowering urge to do the same exact mistake over and over again. So what happens is he goes through his entire life. He makes all the mistakes again, getting thrown out of school, ticking his uncle off by going out with his maid and, all kinds of things. And it's a very colorful story. But what happens is he winds up at the magician's shop again. And the magician reminds him that he came there before and this whole thing had already played out. So they do this whole kind of rigmarole. But the now remember, this is Ouspensky writing this yarn, but he puts in a lot of his own philosophy with it. And here's what the magician says to Ossakin, which gives us a hint, I think, of where Ouspensky is coming from in general. Quote, a man can be given only what he can use. And he can use only that for which he has sacrificed something. So if a man wants to acquire important knowledge or new powers, he must sacrifice other things important to him at the moment. Moreover, he can only get as much as he has given up for it. You cannot have results without causes. By your sacrifice, you create causes. Now, this is kind of interesting because we're leaning into what could be said to be very Gurdjieffian language, as we'll discover here. So some of writing Ossigan was predictive, you know, in his own mind. So continuing here now, he says, by your sacrifice, you create causes. Now the question as to what to sacrifice and how to sacrifice. You say you have nothing, not quite. You have your life. So you can sacrifice your life. It's a very small price to pay, since you meant to throw it away in any case. Instead of that, give me your life and I will see what can be made of you. That is, he's going to give him directions on all these things to do to kind of evolve, in a sense, and to actually grow. But he's telling him that, you know, you have to basically give up the life that you had. And then he goes, I shall not require the whole of your life. 20, even 15 years will be sufficient. When this time is over, you'll be able to use your knowledge for yourself. So we can see that Uspensky is already exposed to a number of different Eastern philosophical traditions and mystical ideas by the time he runs across Gurdjieff. And, you know, he first meets Gurdjieff in 1912, where he's already now been around the world. He's already looked for mystery schools and found nothing, according to him. But they're so well hidden, he couldn't penetrate into them. But there were yogi schools, there were, you know, fakirs, there were people who could do incredible things with their body, mind over matter. But the actual schools were gone. Right? They were sort of existed in some other time, and he couldn't have access to them. So when he meets Gurdjieff, it's kind of like all of his dreams come true all at once. And Gurdjieff represents that mystery tradition in the flesh. So Uspensky has just written Tertium Organum, which is his book about the third canon of thought. And it's very heavily influenced by theosophy. It's largely philosophical book about how we need to know the nature of reality, mixed with some of his physics and mathematics musings, which is really some of the best stuff that he does. Still trekking with me there, Miss Olivia?
Absolutely. I'm wondering when you're going to get to the cat.
Uspensky was a huge, and I mean a huge, cat fan. And by the end of his life, he would drive around with all of his cats in his car to his favorite places. And they say that he had up to 20 cats.
That's
which
amazing.
Is quite remarkable. And interestingly enough, cats play an interesting part in his book because he, in Ossigan and in his other book, this is an interesting book. It's kind of rare now. I don't know if you can get it. I've got the original edition. It's Talks with a Devil. And it is, this person goes to India and they literally run across the devil and ask him a bunch of questions. And it's quite remarkable because over and over again, you know, whenever he wants to do something idealistic, it's the devil that proves to be right. But there's also another short story in here called The Inventor about the guy who created the first handgun. And so it's quite a remarkable book. But I think what we're getting with Uspensky is that there's this early period where he's writing fiction and expressing the ideas that will become kind of the foundation of the fourth way. And the book he's most famous for, which is In Search of the Miraculous. Now, when we get into that phase where he meets Gurdjieff, Gurdjieff is an enigmatic character who comes on the scene, and Uspensky knows all the intelligentsia in Moscow. And the revolution is just, you know, starting to hear things about it. It hasn't kicked in yet. And it creates quite a quite an atmosphere. It's another shot of Uspensky to give you some idea of the intensity of the man. But by the time he ran across Gurdjieff, he was set because he finally had found someone who represented the mystery school. He was going to work with them and develop his system. Now, the system is very complex. I mean, I've studied it for many years, and I've spent a lot of time with those groups who were studying it just to get a real feel for what they were all about. And, you know, my feeling is that there's something in the mystery school tradition of Gurdjieff, which is different than the mystery school tradition that informs Steiner's tradition and theosophy. It's a real curveball. It's almost like an experiment where they sent him out to teach humanity how to not be mechanical, how to not be asleep, and how to really deal with a kind of nuts and bolts style ascension. So it is quite amazing. But the idea basically being that humanity is asleep and needs to wake up fundamentally. So they always go back and cite this interesting analogy from the East, where the situation of humanity is that there's a carriage, a horse and a carriage, and there are blinders on the horses. The driver is asleep, and the master's in the carriage yelling to the driver to wake up. And the carriage and the horses are out of control. And if somebody doesn't take control of it, it's going to crash, obviously. There are some versions of that story, too, where the master in the back seat is bound and gagged, which I think is interesting, because if you were to have an analogy of our inner self and how it's overpowered by all these outer impressions in society and overwhelmed, and how we have these hidden abilities inside of us. You know, one of the lines from the fourth way system that Gurdjieff said was that, you know, mankind lives in a library and a mansion with all these libraries, vast rooms, you know, incredible master bedrooms and all this stuff. But he spends most of his time in the kitchen in the basement. And this is a philosophical observation. So how do we get out of that kind of just day-to-day run of living into something more worthwhile? I would say fundamentally, the breakthrough in the fourth way tradition is that there's an understanding that there's a second reality operating side by side with our everyday reality. And it is a far more vivid reality. It's far more informed. And it lifts you out of the kind of dull consciousness that the society at large sort of imposes on you from childhood. And the question for someone like Uspensky was, how do you get it? Because he knew that it couldn't be gotten in the ordinary conditions of living. So by the time he runs across Gurdjieff, I have some great material on Gurdjieff, but Gurdjieff had a very interesting ethic, which is, if you really go back and study Gurdjieff, in every story, he's always working on something. And very often the work doesn't even represent some immediate value. The idea is just to keep work happening. So, you know, whether it's throwing a dinner party or putting up wallpaper or, you know, assembling rugs, you know, like he was always involved in using his body and using that body-mind connection so that he never got out of his body into a kind of a fantasy place. And this was a crucial aspect. And fundamentally, what Gurdjieff taught him was that you need to be in a state where you are spending the least amount of energy on things that you don't need to spend your energy on. So you don't get upset when someone cuts you off, you know, when you go to park, or you don't get upset. You save that energy and you learn a whole entire different way of being. And there's a number of exercises that they teach for that, including self-remembering. And it is quite a remarkable teaching on its own. But keeping in mind how the mystery schools form such a crucial part of what we're studying with the X-Steganography series, anything that comes out of the Gurdjieff system, in my opinion, is an incredible clue to the different mystery schools that exist. Because I think we understand the ones that are informing the Steiner Theosophy, Anthroposophy tradition a little bit better than the Sarmoon Brotherhood. The Sarmoon Brotherhood seems to take it from the top that your physical body is the crucial aspect, and that if you have control over the physical body and you're spending the least amount of energy with your physical machine, then your mind then is free to develop these other qualities of seeing a higher reality. That's kind of a crucial part of the Gurdjieff system. This is a shot of Gurdjieff working. Actually, I always think it's good to show him in action. And there he is getting ready to apply some paste to a wallpaper. Whenever Gurdjieff groups got together, you know, whenever Uspensky's groups got together, they got philosophy, they got lessons, they got life lessons. But when Gurdjieff's groups would get together, they would do things like, you know, chop vegetables and wash dishes and put up wallpaper and chop wood. You know, it was a very interesting body-centered awareness exercise. Some of the odd things about Gurdjieff when he shows up on the scene, although he meets supposedly Uspensky by accident, it seems quite planned. It seems like they're very aware of him. As a matter of fact, Gurdjieff references his book, Tertium Organum, and says to Uspensky, you know, if I were to, if read your book, and if you understood everything that was in your book, I would bow down to you right now. You wouldn't even be coming to me to learn anything. He said, but the problem is that you neither understand what you read or what you write. And this kind of shocked Ouspensky, who had been through these things of going to the East, and said, look, you know, I've studied with masters. I did all this stuff. I was looking for the mystery schools. You know, when I did Tertium Organum, that's where I thought I was going. There's a quote in Tertium Organum, which is A Key to the Enigmas of the World, which is an incredible book. And I think it's a foundational book for mystery school thought. There's no question about it. And I put it right in there with Knowledge of Higher Worlds by Rudolf Steiner, or The Case of Material. It comes in from a different angle, but it is definitely on that level of one of these volumes that can really lead us to a better place. The quote is, I've called the system of higher logic Tertium Organum because for us it is the third instrument or the third law brought after Aristotle and Bacon. The first was Organon, the second Novum Organum, but the third existed before the first. This is very important. Over and over again in mystery school traditions, it is the things that are coming in, what they're giving us, already existed. That they are the more advanced. They are the legacy that the mystery schools have held, so that we've developed things on our own, like Bacon and Aristotle developed certain thinking modes that we take for granted now. But Tertium Organum is something that already existed back there with the mystery schools, and here he was bringing it out again. This is a theme that we see in the message of the mystery schools, and I think it's something that is worthwhile to pay attention to. And Miss Olivia, while I get these Gurdjieff shots together, why don't you tell me what's going on out there?
Well, they were asking about Astana, which I didn't know about, which is the capital city in Kazakhstan.
Yes.
With the Masonic symbols. Do you have anything to say about that?
No, not really. No, I do think it's interesting. There's varying degrees of Masonic influence. And of course, I mean, people think the Masons are at their core. As you know, you have this kind of exoteric outer circle with the Masons and the esoteric inner circle. And so when you meet someone who's a Mason, it's like those degrees that I described to you earlier, where you have the mystery schools, you have the lesser schools. When you get the arcane schools and then the study groups, private study groups, and then public study groups, most of the Mason stuff is like a public study group gone into private study. That's about the level that it's at. So an average Mason is not going to be exposed. I mean, they'll be exposed to the motions of learning the Masonic tradition, but they're not going to be exposed to mystery school knowledge from joining the Masons. You know, it's an exterior kind of a thing. There is a core to the Masons that understands the history and all the rest of it. So you are, I guess, a little bit closer to that core when you join the Masons. But there are a lot of different reasons to suggest that, you know, the Masons don't represent the true mystery school tradition the way that we understand them in the 21st century. But that's a great question, actually. I want to remind everyone that you're watching The Dark Journalist Show. This is the ex-steganography series, where we study the impact of this X imagery, as I've shown in over 30 episodes here. Very often I'll pick up the X and show it from time to time. In this one, I'm going to show there's a variety of X's in the Enneagram. People might know this symbol because for a little while, it was brought out. There was a trademark battle over this, by the way. But interestingly enough, Gurdjieff brought it out to Ouspensky, and it came right out of the Sarmung Brotherhood tradition. And the Enneagram as a symbol was to be understood as a moving symbol, which is why they did all the sacred exercises to the Enneagram. Later, oddly enough, some of these guys like Icazo and these other people who came up, I think it's Claudio Aranjo, he brought forward these personality systems based on the Enneagram. And he said, oh, I never read Gurdjieff's books. This is my own discovery from South America. But I can tell you, everyone, that all that stuff was just derived from the Gurdjieff work. As a matter of fact, Claudio had been in a Gurdjieff group. It was discovered later. So much for that. But they came out with a very interesting thing about it, which is he must have heard in the groups that it was about personalities and realized, aha, the Ouspensky Fourth Way people didn't tell us about that. But this system that Gurdjieff said came out of the Sarmung Brotherhood has the ex-steganography at the heart of it. And he said it was the way that the mystery schools identify what level the students are on. So it certainly is the measure of activity and experience in that mystery school realm, working with that knowledge. In one of Gurdjieff's earliest sort of ads for the strange work that he was doing, this doesn't make any sense. It's quite remarkable painting, but you can see the Enneagram is in here behind this interesting character. And over here we have a devil and here's an angel. And all these little tools in between, books, paintbrushes, and so on. I think that's the important material really to pay attention to when we're getting in here. So over time, basically Uspensky gets obsessed with Gurdjieff's system, and Gurdjieff plays a very interesting game of how Uspensky needs to earn it. You know, if he's going to learn it, he's going to earn it, as we said earlier. That's the actual design without the triangle in the middle of the Sarmung Brotherhood. If that is the Enneagram, and when you put the triangle in the middle, it really becomes the full Enneagram. Gurdjieff's mystery school teaching is quite unusual because it's without really an organization. He's coming out and teaching mystery school principles to audiences and giving them this impulse and this information. And this is a shot really from that period where Gurdjieff is just coming over and giving up this exceptional information coming out of the mystery schools regarding the system of waking up, as it were. And the personal development aspect of the Gurdjieff work is well known. It has always seemed to many people to be so different. And if you really read it, it's very different than anything out there. You know, whereas some of these traditions have certain things in common, like theosophy and anthroposophy, the Casey work, they have a lot of things in common. But really the Gurdjieff thing comes out of left field. It's, what is it, you know? And according to him, it came from these different brotherhoods. Now there's a very interesting interview with Uspensky years and years later, where they're asking him about his time with Gurdjieff, who he had split off from. And Gurdjieff became a weird enigma for him because this was a tough situation, because he sought his whole life to find a master to work with a mystery school, and here he was. But Gurdjieff started doing things that Uspensky objected to, basically, and he started to, you know, kind of create conflicts unnecessarily, and he just became erratic in Uspensky's opinion. So some of the good questions from this I think are very telling. I'm going to read a couple of them here. This is from November 4th, 1937. So it's about, I'd say about 15 years now that he had stopped working with Gurdjieff after supporting his work and really bringing him to a Western audience, because Uspensky became incredibly well established. And Uspensky, being that Russian philosopher, I think that we need to be very aware of. He's just a remarkable impact on all this. If we want to understand ex-steganography, and if we want to understand the mystery schools, going through the eyes of somebody like Uspensky, who spent all this time with Gurdjieff, we get a hint. We're getting closer. So questions about Gurdjieff were not permitted, by the way, in the groups. He really had been cut off. But a question came up because Uspensky said about Gurdjieff, "Gurdjieff gave me many new ideas I did not know before. And he gave me a system I did not know before," which is interesting because Uspensky had really studied all the esoteric literature, so it was really quite new. "About schools, I did know, for I'd been traveling and looking for schools for 10 years. He had an extraordinary system and quite new. Some separate fragments of it could be found elsewhere, but not connected and put together like they are in this system. And certain things, particularly belonging to the psychological side, were quite a revelation." You know, one of his famous books, Uspensky's, is The Psychology of Man's Possible Development. It's possible development. It's not guaranteed. You're not going to naturally evolve into it. You have the possibility of acquiring it. I think that's what he was trying to put across there. "So like he's saying, separate fragments of it could be found elsewhere, but not connected and put together like they are in the system. Certain things belonging particularly to the psychological side were quite a revelation. And also on many other lines, this was sufficient proof to me that the system was not a thing one can meet with every day, and I had already met with a sufficient number of schools to be able to judge. So the question is, did you ever ask Gurdjieff about the origin of the system? And Uspensky answers, we all asked about 10 times a day, and every time the answer was different. Did you ask Gurdjieff why he always gave different answers? Yes. What did he say? He said he never gave different answers. Unbelievable. Has it ever crossed your mind to regret having met Gurdjieff? This is quite an extraordinary thing, because Uspensky was a very well-established esoteric philosopher who gave lectures, and he was far more famous than Gurdjieff was when Gurdjieff met him. And studying Gurdjieff's system brought him a lot of heartache, in a sense, because he couldn't get at the truth and he couldn't work with Gurdjieff anymore. So this person asked him, has it ever crossed your mind to regret ever having met Gurdjieff? And Uspensky says, never. Why? I got very much from him. I'm always very grateful to myself that after the first evening I asked him when I could see him next time. If I had not, we would not be sitting here now. But you wrote two very brilliant books before you met him. They were only books. I wanted more. I wanted something for myself. I think that's a very telling thing. He had dropped his own arrogance and wanted to study something. Where did the schools come from that taught Gurdjieff? Excellent question. Everyone has always wanted to know about those schools. Uspensky's answer, having spent all this time with Gurdjieff, having studied it, having gone to the East himself to find these schools, here's the answer. It's possible to understand that it was somewhere in Central Asia, but what it was, I don't know. Gurdjieff gave several descriptions, and one of them was very interesting and possible. You must understand the situation after the Russian Revolution. The possibility to go to that country disappeared. If life were normal, I would go there and try to find this school, but as it is, there was no possibility to go there. You know, it's like us trying to go to Iraq or something. And probably now everything has disappeared. One school he described was near Kashgar in Chinese Turkestan. But round it, there's been a war ever since. So probably nothing remains of it now if there was such a school. Now, you know, I exposed on this program the strange situation of the ISIS group going after what are known as mystery school traditions among groups like the Yazidis, for example. And here we have Uspensky describing these war conditions around the mystery school that taught Gurdjieff. So they're always on the run, even if we don't see it. And always if there's a topical reason, like, yes, we need to go into Iraq, or, you know, many of the schools that Gurdjieff talked about were in Afghanistan. We spend all this time bombing Afghanistan with bunker busters. You wonder sometimes about that. You know, and you hear wild stories like, well, they're bombing giants in stasis chambers, you know, and, you know, really silly stuff. The Michael Salas stuff. But I think it's interesting to look at this idea of why do we bomb these countries? You know, it's not always just the political situation. Look what's going on in Syria now. One of the things I had a conversation with Catherine Austin Fitz about was this extensive underground tunnel system that was found in Syria shortly before all these wars had come up. And it was much older than anything like ISIS or anybody. So what were they moving around down there? Where did it come from? These are all the really good questions. I think this is what we need to move into. I'm going to remind everyone that you're watching the Dark Journalist Show. It's great to be here. It's a special Saturday night edition of the show because we had such a wild week and we had to recap so much of it yesterday that I felt it was important for us to get to work on our X series and moving with that information. Now, I do feel that it's important with all the things going on, even with the fact that last night's video was half there, and that everyone should sign up for the newsletter at the darkjournalist.com website. That keeps us in touch directly. It's kind of the only and the best tool for doing that. And there's all the social media, of course. You can join facebook.com/darkjournalist, twitter.com. We're very active on there right now, /darkjournalist. And the YouTube channel, which a lot of people, like Cliff High, for example, how many times did he get unsubscribed?
15.
It's amazing. This is what happens, literally. You know, if they don't like your content, this is what they're going to do. They're not going to unsubscribe. your channel from people's feeds. It's a very unusual process, but we've been through it for a long time, so I don't get upset about it as I'm used to it. But I do think the newsletter is the best way to do that. And I want to make a statement here about the information, even with this trademark situation that came up over the last week. You get a real hint here of the groups and the people who came forward to correct the situation. That's where we need to support things in the alternative media. Get behind the things that are giving you life, not feeding you stories, but are giving you real information that might be useful for you in your day-to-day life, in your spiritual quest, in your psychological evaluation of yourself and the world, in your relationships, in the geopolitical situation, in the financial situation. You need the good info in order to move forward with it. You know, you don't need Kabbalah rests and, you know, the latest update about the Kazarian mafia or what is it? We know where it's coming from too. And they've been running the same track. You know, one of my things as a journalist is I go back and I study what people did before, and I'm pulling out all the stuff from 2010, 2011. It's the same stuff. They've been feeding us people this line of bull. And, you know, people run around after that because they're like, oh, the deep state's getting sent to Gitmo. You know, in the meantime, it's the deep state writing the stuff and keeping you happy and keeping in that kind of, they call it in 1984, the 2 minutes hate. You know, they give you your freak out and you're okay, right? You're in that kind of brainwashed state and you think everything's fine.
In a way, it's kind of, that's sort of the plan, is to keep you excited about the new things, you know, right. The latest, the current events, you know, what's new today, what's new this minute. But what we're uncovering is that the really interesting stuff is what happened long ago, you know, the ancient secrets.
Well, this is what informs the present, because it's the mystery schools who get engaged. And, you know, it's the war of the mystery schools that creates the deep state, in my opinion, because the deep state becomes a symptom of their falling out. So if we understand the mystery schools, if we understand what took place, then we don't need this circusy, you know, hey, cabal arrests are coming, get ready for Soros at Gitmo. It never happens. Hillary was supposed to be at Gitmo. There's supposed to be photos of her. We don't use Gitmo for that. They still don't, you know, they have some terrorists down there still trying to ship them out. There aren't any military tribunals. It's all BS. So that's that whole attention thing. You know, it's amazing to me because it's embarrassing. You know, look at the headlines in the alternative media from last year. It's all about Gitmo and all that stuff. None of it ever happened. And these are the types of predictions where people waste their time. And this is why the Gurdjieff work and the Uspensky work about telling you, look, you have so much time and so much energy to evolve spiritually, personally, in your relationships. And you can't afford to waste time on things that aren't giving you the real thing. So get behind those things in alternative media, you know, and take your entertainment where it comes. I know that some things can just be entertaining, and that's fine. But I would say, I think, you know, when it comes to the alternative media, the fantasy stuff tries to blur the line and pretend that it's authentic, you know. So galactic ambassadors and this kind of thing. Meanwhile, it's years and years later, and none of their predictions have panned out. And, you know, more and more people come out and say, hey, when I worked with that group, I got screwed over, or this or that group, whatever it happens to be. We have to pay attention to that and say, there's quality work that exists in the alternative research field. Yes, it can be like the Wild West, but there is quality work. You can find Catherine Austin Fitz. Catherine Austin Fitz has missingmoney.solari.com, which is an ongoing update about the missing trillions from the government that she is providing for free. You don't even have to pay for it. It's remarkable. Look at all the incredible information that's available for you. Get behind these sources. Get behind the Dark Journalist Show. Get behind Dr. Joseph Farrell. Get behind Catherine Austin Fitz. You know, and there's so many I could name. Cryptogon.com is a fantastic site. Donate to that site. They do great work. You know, tell people about them. These are the good foundations. We're going to do a show just about really good channels that are available. And I wanted to mention, because I didn't get around to praising her last night for her work around the whole trademark thing, mention our friend Rachel from The Pursuit of Happiness, who did some terrific videos around the
pigtails.
Trademark. Pigtails. You can't beat the pigtails girl. So she's out there, and she's doing fantastic. Okay. after all that, we're getting back into Uspensky and Gurdjieff. And I think one of the things we have to stop and examine and take apart here is the fourth way. What are they talking about? It's interesting to think about. What happens is Uspensky asks Gurdjieff, you know, what, how am I going to evolve here? How does a human being evolve in the situation of life? What's the way, you know, kind of what is the path to human development? And Gurdjieff said, well, that there's three traditional ways that have existed from time immemorial. And those ways are the way of the fakir, the way of the monk, and the way of the priest. And the way of the priest is devotion. The way of the fakir is this kind of mind over matter, basically. And the way of the yogi is this incredible development of mind and spirit. Now, what's interesting about that is all of those things need to be developed inside of traditions. And very often they have to be done away from the centers of society. That is, you go to a monastery and study with a priest, an advanced priest. If you're a yogi, you study with an advanced yogi. And a fakir, if we don't know that term, it's like lying down on a bed of nails. And these guys in India can do this stuff and take tremendous pain. And I guess our modern counterpart is when they walk on coals. Wasn't there a guy who got in trouble? Was it Tony Robbins? It was hot for a while. I remember that. And then these guys, thinking they could do mind over matter, started walking on the coals and burning their feet because they just weren't there. Because it is hard to mass market that type of advancement. So a lot of those people found themselves getting into trouble. But I would say the fakir falls along that line. It's like walking on hot coals. And they come out of traditions where they're taught these things in different types of schools. They're kind of splintered off from the mystery schools. And there's a lot of experiments about what people can take and so on. But anyway, what Gurdjieff introduces to Uspensky is that there's a fourth way that exists that can only be achieved in everyday life. That is, I can't go to a monastery and do the fourth way. I can only do it when I'm doing my regular job, when I'm in regular society, when I'm with my family. I can be working on it all the time. So I have to stick to the conditions of everyday, ordinary life. It's not a secret tradition. It is, I'm right there in the middle of everyday experience. That's what Gurdjieff brought forward. The mystery schools decided, in my opinion, to send Gurdjieff in to try this out on society. There are people who might say, well, you know, Gurdjieff gave us the system through Uspensky, and then Gurdjieff kind of lost his way. And then some people say, well, Uspensky was just a regular guy. I mean, he was smart and everything, but he didn't have the advanced mystery school knowledge of Gurdjieff. So when you study his stuff, you're not getting the real thing. And in that movement, we've been caught between those two over and over again. But the important thing is that in that system that came out of the mystery schools, there are answers that can help us to understand that psychology of our possible development. That's crucial. Because one of the main things about the fourth way is that it teaches you not to identify. So you know how you have people running around on one side or the other on the political spectrum, and you have people wound up and kind of psychotically attached to ideas of Democrats and fascist Trump. And then you have the Trump people looking at the Democrats and saying, well, you know, you guys are all socialists and I'm with Trump and all that, you know. And you know, everybody has their advantages. I'm not taking a political position on that. But what I'm trying to point out is that, especially at this time in history, there's a kind of mania that goes with it because it's enhanced by the technology. So getting to this core of how to stay awake and not identify, I would say, is absolutely important. Let's just take a little bit from In Search of the Miraculous from Uspensky's conversations with Gurdjieff regarding this. Quote, in the ordinary conditions of cultured life, the position of a man, even of an intelligent man who is seeking for knowledge, is hopeless. Because in the circumstances surrounding him, there is nothing resembling either fakir or yoga schools. This is true. We can't learn those traditions just you know, you're not going to see that kind of things advertised at a billboard and learn it. While the religions of the West have degenerated to such an extent that for a long time there's been nothing alive in them, various occult and mystical societies and naive experiments in the nature of spiritualism, as we talked about, that big rage, seances, Ouija boards, talking to ghosts, mystical societies and naive experiments in the nature of spiritualism and so on can give no results whatever. According to this system, because you don't have the knowledge of what's happening and how that contact is occurring, they can't give any results. You can agree with that or not agree with it, but that's where they're coming from. The position of man would indeed be hopeless if the possibility of yet a fourth way did not exist, a way beyond the priest, the yogi, or the fakir. The fourth way requires no retirement into the desert, does not require a man to give up or renounce everything by which he formerly lived. The fourth way begins much further on than the way of the yogi. Interesting. This means that a man must be prepared for the fourth way, and this preparation must be required in ordinary life and be a very serious one, embracing many different sides. Furthermore, a man must be living in conditions favorable for work on the fourth way. I love when we get the lines from Gurdjieff, because he's always saying something a little bit deeper, and if you really listen to it. Furthermore, a man must be living in conditions favorable for work in the fourth way. What would be conditions favorable for work in the fourth way? Interesting question. Or in any case, the conditions which do not render it impossible. It must be understood that both in the inner and in the external life of a man, there may be conditions which create insuperable barriers to the fourth way. And furthermore, the fourth way has no definite forms, like the ways of the fakir, the way of the monk, and the yogi. And first of all, it has to be found. This is the first test. It is not as well known as the three traditional ways. There are many people who have never heard of the fourth way, and there are others who deny its existence or possibilities. So this is Gurdjieff telling Uspensky, look, there are traditions of priests. They learn how to be, you know, disciplined to pray and get close spiritually to God and to higher knowledge. The yogi also engages with this, but they become almost like super psychics in a sense. And the fakir works directly from the body. But still, all these different pieces are missing something. But the fourth way gives you the ability to basically develop as they are developing by working on all four sides at the same time in ordinary life. It's quite extraordinary a claim. Let's just go a little bit further with it. At the same time, there are many people who have never heard of the fourth way, and there are others who deny its existence or possibility. That can't be true. There can't be a system outside of these other systems. That's what he's saying. That's what they think. At the same time, the beginning of the fourth way is easier than the beginning of the ways of the fakir, the monk, and the yogi. On the fourth way, it's possible to work and to follow this way while remaining in the usual conditions of life. Continuing to do the usual work, preserving former relationships with people without renouncing or giving up anything. So you don't have to go away and join a monastery or shave your head or become an ascetic or whatever it is.
TJ Liberty Bell is saying, isn't this what we're doing now? This, the fourth way?
I think the fourth way, if you really read about the meetings that Gurdjieff and Uspensky had, it's very much like this, because it's very Q&A, which in the second part of this program, which is coming up, we're going to do a whole Q&A with you guys. And I want tonight to be special, which is I want to ask questions about the nature of spiritual development. And I want you to ask questions that relate to the nature of reality and also Gurdjieff's specific questions. Let's see if we can do that. And really take it along. I'm going to remind everybody that you're watching Dark Journalists. This is a special Saturday night episode. You know, we usually come to you live on Friday nights at 7 p.m. And we go into these different topics dealing with the ex-steganography. The ex-steganography is something I've come across in the past couple of years, but started doing shows on in February of this year. And we've done over 30 episodes now. And I believe that what we've found with the ex-steganography through times is that this mystery tradition uses the X as a symbol, just the same way that the government agencies use that X as a symbol, for secrecy relating to various things that are in these traditions, like what I call apothium. And even with the UFO file, this is all X steganography. Whenever you see things relating to the UFO file, talking about sightings and military documents, that X is always very, very close by. We've demonstrated that over and over again. I wanted to show you a couple I came across to demonstrate this. I'm always coming across them, and sometimes I show a lot of them, but when we get into Hermetic philosophy, when you're getting into the Middle Ages, there is always this impression. Here it's the two X lions that are kind of guarding. Sometimes they call them X dogs. They're guarding that crown, but you have to get through the X that they're on first. The crown's the knowledge that you'll attain by getting through the developments. But these guys are pretty menacing. It's not going to be an easy experience to get there. You have to understand the nature of the reality you're in. You have to understand the nature of your own self. So, you know, higher self, mental self, physical self, these things come into play. And I think what a lot of these traditions in the Middle Ages were trying to give us with the ex-steganography was, look, we've been hiding and holding this information and knowledge for you, but there are ways and means for you to get at it. And I think the way that they communicate with each other is through the ex-steganography. Very unusual thing that happened in the late 1890s is that all these very elite individuals were getting this incredible Bible, which is called the Alternative Bible. And it's actually just the regular Bible, but interestingly enough, this Bible, which was illustrated and had the, you know, kind of an easier reading format, we're going to go very much into the illustrations that have to deal with this in another episode. But the ex-steganography and the way that these groups work, communicating with each other, we see it so much in technology now. And I could, we'll spend a whole show dealing with all the things. You know, we've talked about it in relation to aeronautics, especially. But there's an entire rollout around SpaceX and around technology dealing with the X that is using the very same steganography in order to communicate. What it is basically at a certain point, you get to a level where you can use this. And it actually operates as a great secret. I've pointed out that in the LBJ library and through these different presidents that we've had, from Eisenhower, who had the X time capsule, Nixon, we did famously the Robert Merritt interview about Nixon's X time capsule, which is in the White House, and LBJ's X letter, which is still there, it's to be opened in 2023. That's just sitting in his library. But what's in these envelopes relates to information around the X technology developed and kept secret through the UFO file. So how they're getting that knowledge that develops the X technology, whether they're using the ancient sources or they're using crash retrieval craft from off-world civilizations. Okay, so that's a different type of guess, I would say. But there's no question that the X represents this kind of moving diagram, moving things around on the board, which I think is quite extraordinary. And President Eisenhower and LBJ and people like that, you know, they want their part to be acknowledged when the time comes. So it's important when we look at the ex-steganography to understand what the mystery schools have given us is literally a Rosetta Stone to unlock the language of these traditions. Other people, very important, very well-read researchers have come to me and said, I have this XX and XXX volume and connections for you. And, you know, it's becoming something where it's starting to sing, in a sense. We're getting a lot of feedback along this line. I knew from the point of view of having something like 200 cases of these projects that were developed and went black and then came back up with this X name, that they were doing something about moving this technology through different government agencies while observing a kind of secrecy, the kind of secrecy that you find in a mystery school. I didn't know for a long time that that X-steganography related all the way back to the Egyptian Book of the Dead, and that these were the same symbols that they were using. So this is really quite a discovery, I think, that you and I have had here so far over the past 6 or 7 months on this. So with that in mind, let's go ahead and get a little further into Gurdjieff's story. I'm going to remind you, you're watching Dark Journalist. Miss Olivia, mm-hmm. How are we doing over there?
I already had too many questions, but they're great questions.
Okay, well, you know what? Let's dive into some. Here's one thing I want to point out to everyone. Olivia is now on Twitter.
Yes.
And Olivia Wings Girl, of course, it's O Wings Girl, isn't
it? O Wings Girl.
At O Wings Girl. That's Olivia on Twitter.
And I can see how addictive it is already. It's terrifying.
Well, the other thing is that, you know, Olivia has a great sense of humor. And so we're getting a lot of that online also. So you're going to get a gander of that. Follow her on Twitter. Follow Dark Journalist, at Dark Journalist on Twitter. We are putting out a lot of material there now, so it's kind of handy. It's sort of a good crisscross.
A cult fan has a question. I can feel the urgency in it.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so Olivia, would you ask Dan, in his opinion, what is the single most important technique one can employ in order to aid our evolution in the highest manner, please?
Well, since we're talking about the fourth way, self-remembering is the technique, which is the doorway. Self-remembering is pretty tricky. I mean, it's simple enough. It's kind of a moving meditation.
Can I challenge that? I disagree. Maybe it's my nature.
You think self-remembering is easy?
I think it's really hard, but I don't think it's the most important thing.
You know, in the Gurdjieff tradition, it is. And since we're in the Gurdjieff umbrella, Ouspensky umbrella tonight, when he asked the question,
yes,
I'm going to answer it from the point of view
of
the fourth way.
Well, where would you say, I think emotional non-reactivity to conserve energy is...
That's part of the system.
And it would be, for me, maybe it's my nature, the one that I can work on most.
Well, here's an interesting quote from Gurdjieff on that. That's a very interesting response, Olivia. Here's what I would say. Gurdjieff said that one upset... major upset causes you 3 days of factory activity in your machine. So when you get mad, you know, in traffic or something, and you really fly off the handle, or if you're edgy or whatever, and of course we all get edgy and we all forgive each other and all the rest of it, but I'm saying just in general, according to the fourth way system, when you lose control to that degree, you're expending energy. And it's like an explosion takes place in the factory. And after the explosion takes place in the factory, all these workmen have to go back in and reassemble the material. Maybe they lose something valuable, like a blood vessel. No, but they go in and they fix the factory back. But it takes a few days. So they get into what is happening there. One of the things that I think fascinated Ouspensky in relation to the Gurdjieff work is something like this. It's what Gurdjieff calls the wheel of eyes. And the wheel of eyes is something fundamental there, which is that when you're unconscious, you have a series of reactions when dealing with regular life, when you're in this kind of semi-conscious state that we all live in modern society, when you're not aware, when you're not using self-remembering. So what happens is any shock from the outside, like a traffic accident or good news or bad news, causes a different personality to pop up. So that wheel of eyes, they would name different parts of your personality. If you notice that you're kind of blue in the morning, if you notice that, you know, under certain circumstances, you're going to an event, you feel fantastic, they would name those different aspects of yourself. So they'd give them different names, like Daniel or Michael or Olivia. And, that wheel of eye, though, is an unconscious process that goes on, and you land in it. So one of the ways they described it is, you know, one personality, one of those eyes writes a check for something that they want. You know, they bought a new pair of boots, and then the other eye has to suffer for it by paying it off. So they saw the problem as this wheel of eye and these shocks from the outside creating these reactions and these responses. And the way to stop that, because it's an incredible time waster and you don't have unity, and so you can't really have a decisive will. You can't really set goals and get them accomplished if you're all these different people in different situations. The way to get some unity going was using this self-remembering technique. And I think one of the interesting things that Gurdjieff used when he was demonstrating it in one of his classes was, Olivia, I'm going to have you draw this, actually. Can you just draw two arrows, like one arrow that has two ends?
Oh, you mean
like we have to know that the reason I use Olivia like this, unbelievable artist,
oh,
one
God.
Of the best anywhere.
You mean like that?
Yes, perfect.
Okay.
This arrow represents on one side you looking out at the world. And while you're looking out at the world, you're simultaneously with the other part of your attention observing that arrow is looking back at you. So you're observing yourself, observing the world. It creates a third level of awareness, because ordinarily we're observing the world in our mental kind of associations. I guess our associative mind is going on overdrive. You know, I like this, I don't like that. This person's rude. This person's great. There's a galactic ambassador hassling me and trying to steal my trademark, things like that. And when you get there, it's tricky because if you're just lost in that process, there's no observation going on. Self-remembering was taking that awareness of yourself in any situation while things are going on. And it does create a kind of attention because you're used to just going with the flow and not really being too aware. So it creates a different kind of response, I guess, would be the good word for it. Miss Olivia.
Oh, this is such a great question.
Yes.
So Tikkun Elotre, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. It wants to know, is there a connection between the Wheel of Eyes and the Yazidi Peacock Angel King?
Oh,
what a great question.
Wow. Well, look, the Yazidis were a group that Gurdjieff grew up next to. So let's keep that in mind. When he was in Tiflis, they were right there next to him. They were known as the mountain people. Everyone thought they were devil worshippers. But the Yazidis had kept the tradition of magic through centuries and centuries. And they would intermarry in the group. And they had this very unusual peacock, which we demonstrated in an episode recently with Gigi Young. But so there's no question that they had a great influence on him. And I think the fact that they play a starring role in his meetings with remarkable men about his journeys tells us a lot about, since no one knows where the system came from, the Yazidis may very well have been one of the major aspects of the Gurdjieff system. And it may very well be that the reason they're such a target of unusual groups like ISIS, which doesn't really make sense, and that there's almost these genocides against, they're under UN, the UN has labeled it a genocide, what ISIS was trying to do to the Yazidis, which is a group that's really in northern Iraq, and you know, they're spread out into Central Asia also, but that's where most of their members are. But yes, that is a great question. I don't think we know decisively that that's the answer, but one of the things to getting to the self-remembering with the two arrow is consists of a series of movements physically that you need to learn. And it's quite interesting. I practiced the movements years ago. I haven't done them in a long time, but I worked with people who were quite good at it. And I met people who knew Gurdjieff, interestingly enough.
I didn't know that. I actually knew him?
Oh. Yeah, well, George knew him. You met him too, actually.
I met George.
You did. This is going back a little ways, but Gurdjieff died in 1949, and this guy was pretty old.
Oh, was he the one that spoke in
Harvard
Square?
Okay. Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And he was a great guy, and he knew from some of the exercises and things that he did, he knew a lot. And there
what
were
was
groups...
great is he was so grumpy.
He was, yes, this is part of it. He was not an easygoing kind of a teacher. He had an axe to grind, basically. And I remember the first time I went to see him, about half the audience walked out because they didn't like his harsh manner. But he was taught after the Gurdjieff system, which is, you know, you come out there and you really give him a hard time. We know that there are a few different spin-offs from the Ouspensky groups and from the Gurdjieff groups that really, like the Bennett work predominantly that comes out of that, was the next level of advancement. And J.G. Bennett was the student after Ouspensky. But we'll stick with Ouspensky for now. I want to show you something about these movements because they are quite unusual. And here's the study of the movements in the Mystery School that was set up to study around the Gurdjieff tradition. And Jean de Saltzman, who lived to be 100 and was an incredible choreographer, designed these Gurdjieff, these movements with Gurdjieff that he had got in working with the Mystery Schools. And the Mystery Schools had taught him, look, this is how we preserve books. So these traditions where the Yazidis dance and all this kind of stuff, and even the Navajo here dance, these are book traditions. And the alphabet are the movements. So when you learn the movements, you learn the alphabet. And then when you watch the people dance, you can read the books. Fundamentally, that's really what it is. Here's Bennett, who is Ouspensky's main student, in the 70s now at Claymont, setting up. And he, again, is reinstituting that mystery school tradition with the movements. In this system of the Gurdjieff work and of Ouspensky's work, the movements were crucial because the movements helped you in self-remembering. And they weren't complicated. You didn't have to be some fantastic dancer. There were great people who would do the exercises and would really soar with it. And, you know, it could be almost like a whirling dervish or something. But the exercises themselves would be basically anyone could do them if you studied them. And they would provide this kind of difference in your body. Your consciousness would change. I do remember one thing in relation to those exercises that I can say here, which is that you felt differently after them. You felt like you were learning something about your body, which was helping you be more aware mentally. So a lot of the mental fog lifted when you use these. And they were very rhythmic also, which I think is interesting. Keep going.
Daphne18 wants to know, is there a connection between the Gurdjieff movements and Steiner's eurythmy?
There's no question about it. As a matter of fact, Del Croce, who developed eurythmy for the Steiner people, along with a couple of other people, but he originally had been in partnership with Gurdjieff to do this movement stuff. So there was a crossover there between Steiner. There's another thing, which is there's right in the beginning of In Search of the Miraculous, Ouspensky references Dr. Steiner. So he references Rudolf Steiner, and he talks about his book, Cosmic Memory, which is all about Atlantis and Lemuria, which we covered in a couple of episodes ago. And so Ouspensky was reading that stuff. They were studying Steiner. There's no question in my mind. But Steiner was making that leap, saying that I can, with my senses, apprehend the spiritual realm, learn things, and bring it back here. That leap in the Gurdjieff work, everything comes through your ability to basically control your body, and that these other things aren't tended to, that you're going to be so aware that those things, those possibilities will just come. So they come in at a totally different angle. And I think the issue is this. Theosophy and things like that had a certain quality to them, which is when you start thinking about ascended masters, when you start thinking about the cosmology, that you lose your grounding. This was the fear. No, you don't have to lose your grounding. You can get the cosmology and be grounded. That's what anthroposophy is all about. But because of the grounding factor getting lost over and over again, the Gurdjieff thing is almost like a shaking your shoulders and waking you up and being like, you got to do this the hardcore way. You have to do it through your body. And that will open your mind up to the consciousness of your body, and then you'll become spiritually in touch. So it's a very different type of system. Does that answer the question?
I think so.
Okay. I'm going to show you, this is Gurdjieff directing some of these exercises. And this is the unusual presence of Gurdjieff, just showing up out of the mystery schools and giving us this whole entire tradition and legacy, but nobody knows really where it came from. But it is so advanced, and these schools are so well hidden, and it was such a window on that, that you can imagine Uspensky's kind of conflict when he realized, you know, when he worked with Gurdjieff in the beginning for the first 7 years, he had learned certain things, you know, and he had developed this whole system around. But by the time you get to 1919, their relationship had soured dramatically. And he had seen Gurdjieff create hassles, create conflicts, kind of abuse his power, basically. And he decided to split away from him and teach the system on his own. But Uspensky wasn't an ascended master like Gurdjieff was. I mean, Gurdjieff wasn't ascended, but he had worked with these mystery school traditions. So it was very tricky. And Bennett, who became Uspensky's best student, learning the system intellectually, doing it this way, he said, you know, I worked a little bit with Gurdjieff, basically in 1929, and then again in 1949, the year he died. And in between was 20 years with Uspensky. And he said, but because of the nature of how transformative Gurdjieff was, the 2 years with Gurdjieff did more for me than the 20 years with Uspensky, even though he felt Uspensky was about the best you could get. So that gives you some idea of the level of Gurdjieff's kind of powerful impact on people in regular situations. We have to keep that in mind, but I think Uspensky demonstrates something and is a good example for us, which is the kind of sovereignty of moving ahead on your own path, even if you found a great teaching. There comes a point where you have to make your own decision in the world about what you're going to follow. And I think he stayed true to the Gurdjieff teaching, but he separated the teaching from the man. And that's kind of a good lesson, I think. I'm going to remind everyone that you're watching Dark Journalists. This is a special episode on P.D. Uspensky, who was an excellent author. And his books have inspired me for years. They're always close by. Tertium Organum, New Model of the Universe, is one of the best books, I think. Talks with the Devil is a bunch of short stories, and they're very interesting about his trips to India. And then The Strange Life of Ivan Ossican, more interesting fiction. And his classic major bestseller, In Search of the Miraculous, which, just to give you some idea, I have my original copy here from kind of college time. Let's take a look at that. There it is. It's looking pretty good. It's not bad. It's still held together by tape, but it's nonetheless, in a pinch, it'll still work. I will say this, that when we're looking at these things through the lens of the type of work we're trying to do around ex-steganography, the mystery traditions form the heart of it. So if we can get a handle on the mystery traditions and what they're trying to feed out into culture, we're going to get a lot of those answers that we're looking for. And while I'm on the topic, go to darkjournalist.com, sign up for the newsletter, stay in touch with us. That's the best way, really, for us to get off the ground. Okay, Miss Olivia, we're going to take a few questions here. I'm going to show, this is more dancing on the Enneagram here for people. And this is the development. There are many Gurdjieff groups now studying after the Bennett tradition or Uspensky's tradition, which teach the movements. It's a still vibrant tradition out there. And there it is, in its wonderful symmetry. And I can tell you, those exercises and watching them have that kind of remarkable thing. So, you know, Gurdjieff said, when they said, how would you describe yourself? You know, are you a philosopher? Are you a spiritual guru? What are you? And he said, I am a teacher of temple dancing. Interesting. Kind of a good response.
Where was that taken?
This is actually in New York when he's bringing the groups over to the U.S. and they did the stop exercise and all the rest of it. We're going to do a stop exercise at some point. live on the air. Stop. So, yeah, give me the questions.
Fire away. So was there ever a meeting between Gurdjieff and Rorik?
Not that I know about. I'm sure he's probably aware of him. They were contemporaries. But there is that thing about Nicholas Rorik, and we know he had a great influence on the esoteric impulses of FDR and Henry Wallace, the VP, who was going to be president, who was a theosophist at the Halcyon Temple. And the Varian brothers came out of Halcyon. It all comes around to CERN. But Rorik was really tight with them, and Rorik's wife channeled the Theosophical Masters. And so that whole kind of thing about Rorik going to Central Asia where Shambhala was and all this kind of thing. I mean, they are quite fantastic stories. But, you know, Rorik is mostly celebrated as an artist. You can go to New York right now and there's a whole art wing dedicated to him and his work. So he's an unusual character. It's good to bring up. I don't know if they ever met. I've never run across anything. I think I would have seen it by now.
Did you cover Casey about... You did. Okay.
Yeah. Well,
no,
go ahead.
No, about Uspensky. What he said about Uspensky.
Well, there's so many things about Casey and Uspensky. I'll tell you one really weird thing in relation to this is... Edgar Casey, when he gives psychic readings, they asked him, where are you getting the information from? And he said, very often it is from the subconscious mind of the individual seeking the information. Other times he's tuning into people or situations and he's going where he can get the information. And it would be anything from philosophical, political, medical. He could get any types of different information when he went on these psychic journeys. But there was one time where he was giving a dissertation, an overview, that I found a reading from 1943, and it's about the nature of reality in the fourth dimension. And in the middle of it, or at the end of it, I should say, he says, this is Uspensky giving this. So Uspensky is channeling through Casey in 1943, but Uspensky dies in 47, so he was still alive during this reading. It's quite unusual that he, as a living person, would be connected to Casey enough, who lived in Virginia Beach, and there, you know, I mean, Uspensky did come here to New York, but he's mostly in Russia and London and stuff. It's just very odd that Casey would be channeling him. I think the source that Casey had shows a kind of reverence for Uspensky. So there's one very unusual reading when someone asks him about the book Tertium Organum, and where Casey says, well, this is a very advanced kind of literature around spiritual matters and all the rest of it. And then it's almost like he's speaking half in, half out, a little sotto voce. And he says, yes, well, we find Uspensky here was the keeper of the records in the Mount of the Mahabhas. And he goes, oh, he was born then on the seventh day of the seventh month, the seventh year, 7777. So there's something very unusual about Uspensky. And I think this tuning in that Casey was doing when someone was asking him about Tertium Organum gives us a little hint that there's a lot of magic around Uspensky and that these sevens around him, the way that it's being suggested, it's the keeper of the records in the Mount, being born with all these sevens and the law of seven. It gives us a hint there's something a little extra going on when it comes to Uspensky and the word. I wanted to point this out because Frank Lloyd Wright became a very active Gurdjieff student, and that's J.G. Bennett with Wright setting up a house for one of these group sessions with that. But there are a number of leading 20th century figures who are associated with the Gurdjieff movement. They understood something very special was going on there. Nobody could quite say what, and it was never really answered. Even Uspensky, you know, we know so much of Gurdjieff's work from In Search of the Miraculous, which Gurdjieff himself said was exactly correct from page one to the last page. That is, Uspensky took no liberties with the things that Gurdjieff said. And Gurdjieff, who really despised reporters and all the rest of it, said that Uspensky was an excellent journalist, which is kind of remarkable. But I do think that... there are all these things around In Search of the Miraculous. That was actually the name of a series of lectures that Uspensky gave, and they placed that on the book. But the actual title of the book is far more telling. The title of the book was Fragments of an Unknown Teaching. This is what it is. It's a fragment out of the mystery schools. And Gurdjieff came out, and he's kind of a wild card. I think in a way the mystery schools said, you've learned enough, go out there and let's see what you can do. And I think he did at a certain point lose his connection with the mystery schools. I think that he was a solo operator at a certain time, and I don't think they were directing him anymore, which is why so many things went awry But there it was, again, another impulse added to the stream of our modern culture in order to arouse us, to bring us into a higher state regarding this. Steiner's work, Casey's work, Blavatsky's work, Annie Besant, these are people who are installing an impulse into that river, that flow of ideas. And this is the kind of thing that I think we need to stay on top of. Okay.
Okay. David Tormina, DJ, do you feel the long-term push towards corporate occupations was an intentional way to disconnect people from having to do, I guess, physical work and blocking spiritual experiences?
Isn't that interesting? Mm. Well, all these traditions talk about going back to the land. So they don't expect everybody to be farmers. It's quite illogical. But in truth, having that connection is crucial. So on some level, having some way of having a connection with the land is absolutely essential. What they're moving into now with the transhumanism goes so far away from that. You know, industrialization was one thing. This, where kind of like robots are doing our manufacturing and going to be used as our soldiers and stuff, and then we're going to have robot bartenders and driverless cabs. You know, no wonder in the Gurdjieff work, they were trying to show us, look, you know, your human machine is asleep. Wake up your human machine because the real machines are coming. So I think that they were giving us something there to act as a buffer against the incredible scientific materialism, which transmutes into the transhumanism that we're seeing right now. And it is, I'm telling you, it's very serious. And, you know, it's kind of funny because I like the idea that on Saturday nights we get a little more philosophical, because I think if we can take in this energy, you know, it's a little bit different than on Fridays where letting go of a frantic week. By Saturday, you're really in your center and you can really take in something a little bit deeper. And I think that's what we're doing here. But yeah, keep going.
Okay. Rebecca Westren, please comment on Food for the Moon.
Well, somebody who reads a lot of Gurdjieff there. In the system of the fourth way that Gurdjieff taught Ouspensky and that Ouspensky really became the main proponent of, there are levels and laws that we're under, and we're under a series of laws being on Earth, period, that are unavoidable. But the ultimate kind of zone for restriction in law is the moon, where only certain types of things can happen in the stages of evolution. So in the Gurdjieff work, when you're on Earth, if you learn these techniques that the mystery schools teach that are in the system, you can basically subvert a number of the laws that you're under when you're here, whether that is the law of being, you know, kind of developing emotional patterns that'll keep you chained in patterns of reactions, negativity. You know, the Gurdjieff work refers to negativity as a totally foreign artificial center. So when we have negative thoughts and thinking like that, it's not a normal evolutionary path for our mental body to take. It is entirely artificial. So one of the things that they do in the system is that they artificially repress negative thinking so that you do not express negative thoughts. You do not sit there and go, oh, you know, this guy is late, or, you know, my coffee's too hot, or whatever. You do not verbally complain and bring negativity in. It's quite interesting. Now, I mean, Gurdjieff is known for blowing up people and all that and all the rest of it. So, you know, I'm not saying that these guys walked around and were perfect, but I think the idea from the system's point of view is that you need all that energy. And by being negative, it's a way to kind of dilute any kind of, you know, real big push that you're going to do energetically to advance yourself and to be aware. So it is quite interesting. It becomes like an energy management system. But yeah, keep going.
I have a feeling this is a very wise person in our chat tonight. Tikkun Alatre again. Could the Gurdjieff movements be a form of group meditation and thus a key to developing some sort of planetary consciousness?
It's really interesting. When you watch the Whirling Dervishes, I don't know if I have a picture of them. Well, this is more of the Bennett. These are the Gurdjieff dancers. These are the types of movements that they do. But the Whirling Dervishes look like planets that are moving, if you really watch them. And I think that we're watching astronomical developments there when we see it. There's no question they have an incredible sync with each other. And one of the things at the end of the Meetings with Remarkable Men movie, which is kind of a thinned out, sketchy bio of Gurdjieff's early life, finding the information from the Sarmung Brotherhood, and then finding that Sarmung Brotherhood really still existed, and going into the mountain monastery that they had and learning everything. It is, there are some things there that are very worthwhile, but at the end, Jean de Salzman takes the Gurdjieff dancers and walks us through those things, and it's quite remarkable. I think that it's an eye-opening experience. You get the idea that they are all coordinated, no question.
Yeah, even if you don't sit through the rest of the movie, if you just watch the end in the temple dances are just incredible. They are. They're beautiful, and they're very transporting.
Hey, go, go.
We have a joke about that.
Okay.
Okay.
Yes. You're watching. Wait, hold on. You're watching Dark Journalist here. I want to remind everybody we're on here on a special Saturday edition. We're going to be back on Halloween with a very special episode on CERN Tarot. Yes, I said CERN Tarot. And I'm going to be here with Gigi Young, who will be in costume. And we're going to have some fun that night. There's going to be some surprises. It's going to be Halloween after all. So make sure that you join us Wednesday night at 7. We'll also be back next Friday night at 7. Okay, Miss Olivia.
Okay, Epic Journeyman. Are the movements representative of the symmetry of nature, and are the ideograms symbolic of fractal connections in a linear representation that translate 4D to our 3D perception? I am still a novice.
You don't sound like a novice. Mm-hmm. You probably could teach us what it is. The Enneagram is a moving image. That's what Gurdjieff came across pretty clearly with Uspensky about it. That the only way to understand it is to understand it in motion. We do see that the law of three and the law of seven is incorporated into it. That, and the law of three and the law of seven is in the Gurdjieff work. They describe it. So there is something mathematical and there's something metaphysical going on in relation to it. And when most of these dancers learn the dancing, like with the groups that came after, when they're learning the movements, what they wind up doing is dancing the Enneagram. So we're getting there that the Sarmung Brotherhood handed down this tradition. Suddenly we get our hands on it out of nowhere. Gurdjieff brings it out of the blue around 1920. So it had been hidden and underground for eons, probably since ancient Egypt. So we're being given something there. There are these things that are being passed around, basically, or passed out from the mystery schools. They're giving us these hints, these tools, and they're not giving us all the background about how they work, for example. So, but I think we get some idea directly from what they said about it, which is it's a moving symbol, one, and that it certainly is tied up with mathematics. And the later stuff relating to personality is fascinating. Apparently there were Gurdjieff groups that were studying that, and then somebody ran off and tried to say, hey, I found this on my own. But I do think there's a types aspect in it. Just like in astrology, there's a certain type. I know you, you're a Leo. I know you, you're a Taurus. You're going to have certain aspects to you. The Enneagram has some of that quality when you get to the certain types around the wheel. It needs a lot more investigation. It needs to be brought forward a lot more, for certain. But yeah, those it may very well be what you were saying about it. There's no way to tell. Okay.
M. Monty, which self are we to remember?
Well, the idea is to create a unifying I. That is an I that dominates all the other ones. And there's a few things in the system of Gurdjieff. One of them is, and the reason you have to do group work, is you don't get a chance to see yourself interrelate with other people. So you can't figure out certain things about yourself. One of the most important things in the work is something called the chief feature. And that's only something you can get in group work. So if you're working with a small group of 10 or 12 people, for example, they observe you over time doing these things. They get a hint for what that chief feature is, because the big mystery around the chief feature is you cannot identify it yourself. You need a group to do it. So I can try to take a guess at mine, for example, But the chief feature is such that only people around you can tell you by noticing it and observing it, because you're blind to your own chief feature. However, the chief feature is what all of your different eyes and personalities orbit around. So once you understand the chief feature, you're on your way to consolidating all of that into one central eye, which gives you a kind of a central will. And that will gives you the ability to achieve the goals that you set for things in your life and to kind of reach your ideals in that sense. But when you are scattered, when you are a number of different psychological fragments, then we run into these problems where people don't have that central eye. A lot of that's because they don't know what their chief feature is. And that's a tricky one because, like I said, you need to be able to figure out what that is based on others' impressions of you and who you are. Now, sometimes that chief feature in the system is called the chief fault, around which all your other faults orbit, which is really interesting because the fundamental way that it's used is the chief feature and the eyes. But thinking about it as a fault, something to be overcome, I think is quite remarkable. Gurdjieff told Ouspensky that his chief feature was extreme individualism. Extreme individualism. This is interesting. You know, he didn't have community with other people. He felt isolated in his own work. This is why he had so many blocks. He was brilliant. He understood the traps that humanity was in, but he was such an extreme individualist that he couldn't, you know, kind of bring that experience to them and interrelate. So he worked with that for years, but I think this gives us some idea, some snapshot of the depth of the psychological system.
So, DJ, what's your chief feature?
Well, this is, you know, it's an ongoing process. But certainly...
Do you know it?
Well, I was given a pretty big hint mm-hmm. by some of those people who'd worked with it for a number of years. And but I don't know, until I buy into it completely, I can't mm-hmm. really go on the record. But thank you. It's an excellent question. I think there's no question that it has... It's not too different from Ouspensky's. It's, you know, I mean, I certainly, I'm not as aloof as someone like Ouspensky, but certainly I think in terms of that kind of individualism at all costs, there's probably something of that in there.
Okay. So Carla Struble wants to know, what's supposed to happen to you after you follow the fourth way, ultimately?
What will happen to you? Well... Remember that Ouspensky's book is Psychology of Man's Possible Evolution. You're evolving, and as a spiritual being, a physical being, a mental being. And what's happening is there's a certain amount of evolution that's built in, that is in the regular systems, physically, and all the rest of it around us in the world. However, in that ordinary system, you're not going to evolve to a point where you advance, really. It's going to be slow, steady progress over a long period of time, but it's not really, you're not going to advance in one lifetime. So the idea of the fourth way is that if you want to achieve a kind of will and a kind of spiritual ability and really kind of master your own consciousness and your own physical life and spiritual life, that there's a road, there's a method by which you can do it. Now, some people who are out there from the Steiner perspective would say, well, knowledge of higher worlds contains that. There's no question. There are things in knowledge of higher worlds that will really advance you and your life. You'll become who you are supposed to be because you'll realize and become aware of your own faculties, which is a crucial aspect of becoming a whole person. But I do think that when we get into Gurdjieff work, it's all about you have to earn it, and the method to earn it is through the fourth way. So yeah, it is. It's a good question though. What will you achieve by becoming spiritually evolved? I mean, it's endless.
Right, but the fourth way doesn't include reincarnation.
Well, they leave things out of the system that are put out there. This is an interesting thing about the fourth way, which is they're worried. Since they're concentrating on laziness, basically, on the lazy factor, and they're putting all the emphasis around work, they're worried that if you think you have another series of lives to work all this stuff out. Well, you'll just say, forget about it. I'll do it in my next life. I do hear people say this. Theosophy came out and told everyone, reincarnation is the tradition. You keep reincarnating. That's how you're evolving these different qualities. And the Casey work said, look, reincarnation is there so you will know yourself to be yourself, but part of the whole. So you'll know, you'll come together with your spiritual understanding. In the fourth way, what they're saying is, don't think about reincarnation. Don't worry about that. Deal with this one life right now that you're working with here. You'll get the best results that way. They're not saying it doesn't exist. They're saying it's not part of the system. Just like recurrence, eternal recurrence, which is something that Ouspensky taught, which the Strange Life of Ivan Ossakin is all about, that entire system of eternal recurrence first came up through Nietzsche, who, interestingly enough, Steiner had that relationship to Nietzsche's sister and put out this great book, which was his first debut, and in defense of Friedrich Nietzsche, which is really a brave thing to do in that period, because Nietzsche was thought of as a total heretic who said God is dead and all these different things. And here was Steiner kind of sticking up for him, even though he was coming from a totally different perspective. What's fascinating about all that to me is that, you know, when we look at the third way, the fourth way, and when we look at the systems that it brought forward to us, look what's come out of it. Look how unusual this teaching was. The Enneagram came out of it. Self-remembering came out of it. Stop exercises and the sacred movements came out of it. Where did this come from? The name of the book that Ouspensky said is Fragments. It's fragments of an unknown teaching. He didn't know where it came from. He spent 20 years with Gurdjieff. So very, very unusual work. It's really an injection from the mystery school. It's like an experiment saying, what if we tried it this way? Would people grasp this? They get a handle on this. And, you know, it's interesting. I was talking about Bennett earlier, who I think was the best modern representation. I mean, he died in the 70s of the work. And there's many others, but I think Bennett understood that you had to really get in there and work with the methods and develop your own thing and not just worry about what tradition were they doing. Remember that Bennett, who's featured here as a soldier, and he was British, he had an interesting revelation. They sent him to spy on Gurdjieff, actually, because they thought Gurdjieff was doing this work for a Turkish prince, and that's how he came to know anything about Gurdjieff in the first place. But Bennett, who has a fantastic book called Witness, which I highly recommend everyone get, because he was there working with Gurdjieff and working with Ouspensky. Witness is a great book because it tells us a lot of personal anecdotes to give us a real feature of what was going on and working with these people one-on-one in a real-life situation, not as some strange master somewhere in a mystery school, but really in day-to-day life and how he worked with these people one-on-one. But one of the things that he said was so interesting and led him, while he was spying on Gurdjieff, to become curious about his teaching was that, this is a very interesting scene, but there were a number of criminals that when he got off military leave, he came back to London, and there were a number of criminals in a jail, and they had built this jail where you could walk above ground and look down on the criminals. I'm not exactly sure what this was, but it's in the book. And he thought, there's something fundamentally wrong on planet Earth, and it needs to be, yeah, I need to find some higher reality, because this picture struck something in him. It made his inner self wake up and take notice that here were these people who were literally underground and in an underground jail, who obviously, you know, had committed some crime or whatever, but the idea that the system itself had become this inhumane, and that there were levels where you were supposed to have your ordinary life here while these people were slipping into crime and all the rest of it. There wasn't a balance there. It didn't make sense to him. So he sought out Gurdjieff and Gurdjieff's teaching as a result of this kind of flash. One of the things that happened with Bennett and Gurdjieff, I want to mention here, and it's one of my favorite anecdotes, which is that he said, look, I know you've been in these mystery schools, Gurdjieff. I want to learn these things from you, and I want a crash course. I've always wanted to know, and I've heard about astral travel, leaving your body, having an out-of-body experience. I want to know if it's true, and if you can teach me a method, then I'll be here and I'll work with you at your new foundation for the harmonious development of man. Institute. And Gurdjieff said, okay, I'll teach it to you, okay? And I'll teach it to you right now. And I'm going to give you an exercise. You're going to do the exercise, and I'll come back and check with you. Just make sure you do the exercise, and in about 4 hours, I'll come back. And so Bennett spends a little time on it, Gurdjieff comes back, and he says, what happened, you know? And Bennett said, nothing happened. I wasn't able to do it, you know. I tried it a couple of times. And he's like, you're always starting things, Bennett. What's the problem here? He goes, I'll tell you what. Come back tomorrow, do the same exercise, and we'll do it again. So Bennett comes in, comes back to the Institute. He goes into the room. He's doing the exercise. And he leaves his body. And he's looking around this room and looking down at himself, sitting in this chair doing this exercise. And so Gurdjieff walks into the room, opens the door, and looks at him sitting there in the chair, and then looks up at his astral body and smirks, basically like, huh, you got what you look for. And then he walks out of the room and doesn't say anything. So this is the kind of anecdotes and experiences that Bennett had. Bennett was really, you know, this is somebody who had contacts in government. He was an engineer. He had all kinds of qualities that made him a regular, average, successful person, but he wanted this teaching. He wanted to learn from Gurdjieff, and he studied with Uspensky and Gurdjieff, so he became one of the best people, I think, to learn about their work through. So that's maybe a good answer on that. Okay, keep going.
Okay, well, that leads me to this next question. Amar Sharma wants to know about the higher bodies and how to develop them.
I think the higher bodies are included in the fourth way teaching. When you look at theosophy, theosophy is very interesting because it says you naturally have built into you a spiritual system. And when you tap into that spiritual system, it expands and you become aware of it and you become aware of those realities. And that spiritual kind of flow comes down into you and leads your reality. That's pretty good. That's Blavatsky at her best teaching that. And I think it is quite remarkable. But I think what happens apparently in our system of doing things is that people take spiritual advancement on their own terms, thinking that they're getting somewhere spiritually without realizing the kind of ego factor that comes into it. And so with theosophy, it's very tricky. It becomes an ego expansion exercise where you have people walking around and saying, you know, I am very expanded, and I had a conversation with Master Kuthumi this morning. He gave me these instructions. It's tricky. It's tricky to take that at face value. So therefore, something like the Gurdjieff system, you're humbling yourself, you know. And I remember there's this event where all these people come to meet Gurdjieff, and they're so fascinated by this man from the East. And this guy comes up to him and says, I'm a creative director, and I do all this stuff. And Gurdjieff says, no, you're not. You don't create anything.
He says more than that.
There's a four-letter word in there. But in any case, I think it's an important thing because we have to be humble when we approach this work. And over again, in the West, in the 21st century, everything is about reinforcing your ego. The reality TV star thing, you know, America's Got Talent, whatever it is. Britain's Got Talent. It's such an ego over the top thing. And, you know, some of it's funny and we have to live with it. But I think in terms of leading yourself to a higher spiritual path, you're going to have to get over that. And the first way to do it is to humble yourself before these experiences. When I read, there's a book by Henry Alcott called Old Diary Leaves, which is a 7-volume set, his diary of working with Blavatsky, setting up the Theosophical Society. And it is remarkable. The humility of the man who is incredible, you know, because he was a retired colonel. He had worked on, you know, basically what was the kind of Warren Commission of its time, studying the Lincoln assassination. Because, by the way, the Lincoln assassination, the story that we get is ridiculous. As a matter of fact, John Wilkes Booth is probably buried maybe about 15 minutes from here. The real guy who, you know, the guy that they grabbed there after he shot Lincoln is a totally different guy. And it's just well known, you know, among so many researchers, and the official story won't change it, just like they won't change the dumb Oswald story. But I do think it's interesting when we look at these things and we look at the humility of people like Olcott and look at Steiner. Steiner brought forward biodynamic farming, Eurythmy, Campbell Hill communities for dealing with developmentally challenged young adults. I mean, incredible work. And he brought us the information about the eighth sphere and everything. But do you look at those books and do you have Steiner saying, you know, I'm the top dog, I'm the shizzle? I mean, these are people who are being humble. And what the fourth way teaches is about humility. I think that's what I get from it. Okay, yes.
I know that well. okay, so Nimsa Flugzug, okay, says, once you find a teacher, you have to stop looking for the mystery and let it unfold with as little of your intervention as possible. Hence the need for accepting tedium and work.
Oh, that's a great one. Yeah, fantastic.
I so agree with that.
All right, well, let's do this. We're going to wrap up this episode, but before we do, we're going to take a couple more questions, and then I'm going to close it out with Ouspensky's quote. And I want to say this about Ouspensky, in case I haven't said it. He's one of the most remarkable people who ever tried to bring this information out to an audience on an educational level for their understanding spiritually. He's another one who didn't spend too much time praising himself and his abilities. He was trying to figure out what the system was and what it was all about. He understood that there was another reality that was operating that was outside of our normal channel, normal everyday consciousness. He wanted access to it. He understood that there was a problem. And this is the kind of important thing, I think, about his work. He was a great writer. He was a fantastic journalist. And he, you know, some of the absurdity of life really got to him, I think. And there's only one picture of him with Gurdjieff. I'm going to show it to you. And I want you to keep in mind that Ouspensky's early life was colored with the fact that his sister was put in prison for political activism, and he had to go visit her in prison. And we don't have the complete record on this, but it appears that she died there. And he was pretty young when that happened. So you can imagine the kind of deeper search that he was on. And here's the only picture of him with Gurdjieff in the record that I've been able to find, even though he spent all those years with him. And that's Gurdjieff in the front, and here is Ouspensky in the back, just laying back, being that...
Are there any pictures of him smiling? I mean, he's the grimmest man. I have such sympathy for him.
He was on a track. He was trying to discover a greater reality, and he just, you know, he has an emo quality about him. There's no question about it. But he got so far with it. I'm sure in private he must have smiled once or twice at least. I love these late pictures of Gurdjieff at the very end, because he'd been split off from Gurdjieff for 20 years or more, maybe about 25 years. And before Gurdjieff died, Ouspensky died, and his book came out, because Ouspensky, again, didn't publish In Search of the Miraculous while he was alive. He didn't want to be kind of the counterpoint to Gurdjieff on that. He waited till, you know, he left instructions to publish it when he died. Again, incredible sacrifice on his part and showing the integrity of it. And when Gurdjieff got his hands on In Search of the Miraculous, he said, it's remarkable how accurate everything is. So we know that that's the best document of the Gurdjieff work. And this is a shot of Gurdjieff at the end, who came out of the mystery schools to give us something, this fragment of an unknown teaching, and the incredible dances and the incredible symbols and the incredible knowledge that he brought forward. And so the question is always there, did he achieve his goal? It's a good question. It's a hard question to answer. You could say he was a flawed messenger, but he gave us so many things that we didn't have. And I think Ouspensky understood that, which is why he spent so much time with him. And I think that their relationship is one of the most classic things, you know, in that teacher-student relationship. And at a certain point, even with a master from a mystery school, Ouspensky had to say, I'm cutting my own path. And that is also one of the last pictures of Gurdjieff also. Gurdjieff played the harmonium incredibly well, and the Gurdjieff music is one of the greatest things I think I've ever run across. There's great work with him and Thomas DeHartmann. And someone has a question up there about Fritz Peters, and I love the Fritz Peters books because they are so interesting. And Gurdjieff had to basically adopt Fritz Peters after Fritz Peters' parents kind of joined up, and the mother became single, and she took Fritz Peters into the institute. And then something happened to the mother, and Gurdjieff basically was stuck in the role of being something of a strange father figure to Fritz Peters. And Boyhood with Gurdjieff is the name of the book. So I want to remind everyone that you're watching Dark Journalist. We've been having a fantastic week with everyone with our campaign for No SSPTM, which did come to pass. They did give up the search for the trademark on that. And so we had just a terrific combination of people coming together around this. We're back with the X series here, and we're going to be back with the X series part 33 on Wednesday with Gigi Young, which is the CERN tarot deck. And I'll tell you, there's going to be a lot coming out. I'm going to do another episode centering around Uspensky and Bennett's relationship. So if there's anything I left out about Uspensky, don't worry. We're going to be bringing more in about it. And Miss Olivia, you've got the last two questions.
Okay. JJK, DJ, when yes. you have negative thoughts, how do you cope with them? I am curious.
Well, it's interesting with me because, as anyone who knows me can tell you, I have a very interesting shield to negative thinking. And I'm not sure really where I got it. I think there's something kind of built in there. I don't spend a lot of time on it. And, you know, the idea of spending your time wallowing in negative thinking to me is counterproductive, to say the least. But I will say this, that I understand those anxious moments when people get into those states, and it's very important to stay centered and to understand the kind of this too shall pass type thing, regardless of the nature of the situation. You do need to stay centered, especially at the nature of the kind of frantic pace of the world right now. And I think getting in touch with these traditions and reading the things that the mystery schools have left behind, you know, your mind will get so filled up and fascinated by that, you'll forget all about your negative thinking.
Well, I mean, I've been able to watch you for a long time. And I'd say the number one thing that you have going for you is that you are the center of your own world. And I mean that in the best sense. So you, you know, you keep your focus on your life, yourself, your desires, and you do not let things around you throw you off your center.
Do you mean that I'm the shizzle?
Yeah. Well, it's a great lesson for somebody who lets everything throw her off her center. So,
oh, isn't that fascinating? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well,
and then I lose my sense of myself, and I don't know where I end in the world.
I have to say, this is what's great about Olivia is, you know, speaking of not taking credit for herself, you have incredible ability and gift in dealing with people, and wow, you know, just.
But
incredible.
I don't deal with stress well. Or I'm learning.
Hey,
slowly.
That's a process. You know, I think. Here's an interesting thing. You made me think of this, which is Alcott, when he met one of these masters, this was dealing with Blavatsky. And dealing with Blavatsky, apparently, it was problematic. Like, she liked to shout. She liked to really get in people's faces and stuff. She was really obnoxious. And so Alcott, who was her partner starting the Theosophical Society, goes to one of these masters and goes, why on earth does she have to act like this? You know, like, do we really have to put up with this? I mean, couldn't she have a better disposition? And this is quite interesting. The masters informed him that she couldn't do what she did psychically, operate on that level, if she didn't have some kind of outlet. So the hot-blooded kind of like ferocity to her was a weird balance against that psychic ability. So we can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. You know, it's nice to get a hand on those things. Like, we don't want to let our anger get the best of us. We don't want our negative thinking to get the best of us. But what I think is interesting is, you know, what Olivia was saying there about stress. We have to find a solution for dealing with stress in our lives. There's no question about it. And meditation is a good solution. Deeper understanding is a good solution. But it's a crucial aspect to help us express who we really are. You know, those tools for soul expression are there. Okay.
A cult fan wanted to say that he worked for George McCarrion. That was the name of that man. And that George made him drive a Class C truck without knowing how.
How did you come to work for George?
I know.
And also describe George, if you can, in the comments there. So keep rolling until he does that, because I want to see if that's the same guy.
Okay, so Bo Krills really wants to know how you are so sure that mystery schools don't guard the tools for the elite instead of for the people.
There's a longstanding tradition of the mystery schools moving humanity forward. And there are elite groups that try to get their hands on mystery school knowledge and use it for themselves. We call them groups of the left hand. Those are the mystery school traditions. That war of the mystery schools that took place in the 19th century made those kind of stark choices. But if you really look into the work of Steiner and C.G. Harrison, you get a real snapshot of that battle of those mystery schools. Steiner in particular came forward and let us know how a lot of this process worked. Now, I think through study, you come to understand things, you know. So I'm not saying we can understand the motivations of all the mystery schools. Certainly some of them are counterproductive, but I think the mystery school tradition is that higher knowledge tradition to move humanity forward. And I think it's been demonstrated over and over again. There's an incredible plan that they've tried to put in place for humanity's development. And very often the problem is grasping what they're giving us, you know, taking it on. I think the tools are there. It's like everything is there spread out before you. You got to use it. And so it always comes back to us and what we can do. Always worrying about what elites are doing to us, I think, is problematic, because we get into situations where it always feels like something is doing something to us. But in actual fact, what we need to do when contemplating these things, think of the ex-steganography. It came about through years of research. If I hadn't done the research, I'd never would have come across the key. So, you know, it's effort that pays off. I guess that's the bottom line there. But I've learned a great deal from everyone out there. And I want to give all you guys who are watching, and ladies, an incredible vote of confidence for your intelligent questions and for following really heavy information at times that I've brought forward on this show. I found that to be incredibly encouraging, and it's encouraged me to really put a lot of my own efforts behind the work. And I think that all goes together with kind of formulating this conversation, which brings me to go to darkjournalist.com, mm-hmm. sign up for the newsletter, keep us in touch with each other. If you like the material, support the show, get behind it, subscribe. Forget about procrastination. Procrastination isn't it anymore. That's so like back there. Now we're getting involved. We're getting behind the things that are good for us. We're supporting them. And those things are growing. And these ripples, I think, are really taking place. And the week with the no SSPTM, I think, is showing us there is an awareness level rising. And all told, most of the important mystery schools all predicted that their impact and the work that they've done would come back about 100 years later. And I think that's what we're seeing with this wider dissemination of some very important truths. So we're really on the beam with this. Miss Olivia will take the last question, and then we'll come back on Wednesday.
Well, first off, people are ready for a whole extra hour. So a big demand out there.
Well, remember, one of the things about the long, if we draw out the episode too long, we have this weird YouTube thing going on. Maybe it'll be a little bit easier for YouTube to process the video if we keep tonight's tight around 2 hours. So go ahead and
I'm
go for
give
your
you the,
last
the
couple of questions.
Question. Okay. Nancy Dunn, how are you so sure there is reincarnation?
This is a personal experience, but my work on the esoteric tradition, along with the number of stories of people having these memories and being able to find things, for example, we have these classic cases of these children now who are saying, I was a World War II pilot, and then bringing their parents to where the plane came down and the facts checking out. We have cases like that over and over again, ever since Bridie Murphy in the 50s, and Casey's work. You know, I've worked so tightly with the Casey readings and his discussions around reincarnation. There's no question about reincarnation. It's actually in the Bible also, where, you know, there's a thing, a certain point where the disciples come and they tell Jesus about John the Baptist being beheaded. It's very interesting. And then they say, and Jesus says a few things to them, and they're like, oh, do you mean Elijah's coming back? Like, is Elijah going to come back in a chariot? Is that what you're trying to describe? And Jesus says, well, no, Elijah came already, and they did with him what they wanted to. They chopped his head off. And then the disciples understood, oh, he's talking about John the Baptist. So that Elijah had reincarnated as John the Baptist. There's that reference there. And they stripped all the references to reincarnation out of the Bible around the 3rd century A.D., and this Origen, I believe, that did that. So this is why we're stuck with that in the Western tradition without reincarnation, which is a pretty big thing to be missing, let me tell you. Now, it's true in the fourth way system that they don't really concentrate on that. But theosophical teaching and anthroposophy brought that back. It gave it back to us. And I think it's a crucial, crucial piece. Fantastic. And one more, Miss Olivia.
Sorry, I just missed what I was doing. It went by.
Oh, no.
Sorry.
Okay, so
talk about something else.
Well, I think this is probably a good place for us to wrap the show up. Actually.
Oh, I know. Here it is. Amar Shamo again.
Okay.
Talk about Gurdjieff's view of Judas.
Well, he did. He said that Judas had this incredible role and that it had been decided, predetermined, that Jesus was going to be crucified and all the rest, and that Judas' role is something that humanity doesn't quite understand. That whole betrayal was actually something that they had worked out, that he was going to do this in order for the whole event to happen. Now, it is interesting because they found something called the Gospel of Judas later, which showed that Judas was a much closer disciple of Jesus. So it's kind of fascinating, I think, with the way that the stuff plays out, and we're learning more all the time. But I think that Gurdjieff is great like that, which is takes you back in time. And there's this conversation that Bennett has with Gurdjieff. I didn't even go into the kind of weird shape-shifting stuff that Gurdjieff could do. I did mention this in another episode, but you know, there were times when he would do things like appear on the train when Uspensky was going from Finland, going back to Moscow and stuff. He would appear like an apparition, just pop in out of the blue and discuss things with him and take off, like zap out. It's quite extraordinary. But, you know, Uspensky was an incredibly grounded guy. For him to relate this is interesting. What kind of abilities do you get taught in a mystery school to project yourself as kind of an avatar? These are really deep, deep questions, I think. So, yeah. Fantastic. Wow. I'm so excited that we got
into Uspensky Night. All right, can I just do one more?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So, Jake Farron Merlin.
Uh-huh. There's a name.
Yes.
Merlin, starting. Oh, right off the bat, yes.
How about Gurdjieff and improvements in nuclear tech? Does DJ know of Gurdjieff taking part in seances or similar type exercises?
I'll tell you a weird thing. I don't know if this relates to your question, but Pacific Bell, the telephone company, decided to improve their kind of workers' productivity to take on the fourth way as a study. And they implemented it for 3 years. And extraordinary things happened. People's lives were transformed. A lot of their employees quit, which I found interesting too. But it was this very strange study that happened, and they tried this. And then I've never heard anything else about it after that. But we do see these things. I remember spending time with a gentleman who was developing something called capability management. And one of the things that he realized, he was a fascinating German psychologist, he had studied these people, and he realized over and over again when he was studying their capabilities that all the people in these corporations who were capable were at the bottom, and that the people who didn't have the capability were sitting at the top in the leadership positions, you know, if they weren't the actual CEO. So I do feel like, you know, when we apply some of these things into corporate America coming in from the mystery schools, you'd probably increase productivity. You'd increase, you know, there's a lot of meditation programs now that corporations have. unfortunately, the majority of corporations like Apple, you know, when they kind of adopt slave labor practices in China, they what do they do when people are work so hard that they get depressed and they want to jump out a window? They don't give them psychological resources. They build nets so that they can't kill themselves. So unfortunately, that's where most of the corporations sit. But yes, Pacific Bell did this unusual experiment using the fourth way system.
Okay, last question. There are a lot of questions about your books. How many you have, whether you ever loan them out. And
I'll tell you, I've collected books for a long time, and I think I have some really incredible editions. What's great is when doing the work of the series, something will come up and I cannot get the answer through online research or in newer books that are coming out. I'll be able to go to those old editions that I have and pull something out. So there are real gems back there. I mentioned a few of them tonight. Old Diary Leaves is one of the greatest things I think you can read. And I remember I was doing a lot of back and forth travel for work to New York City, and I would sit there on the Acela train reading Old Diary Leaves, which is Alcott's description of how the Theosophical Society got formed. And my God, what an incredible journey that it was. Witness is one of the best books from an honest person. You know, it's funny when we trail around and we see these kind of cult figures and things like that in the community taking advantage of people or not being sincere. And then you realize the incredible legacy we've been handed by people like Bennett and like Uspensky, really trying to get at the truth. That's the caliber I think that we need to get our hands on this. And with that, Miss Olivia, I'm going to close down our broadcast, our fantastic live stream Saturday. Thank you for joining me. We'll be back with the X series, Cern Tarot, Qi Ji Young, and a little Halloween fun on Wednesday, an unusual night to do it.
It's going
to
be great.
I cannot wait. And remember to go to Dark Journalists, sign up for the newsletter, subscribe, get behind the show. This is the perfect time to do it. I mean, it's before Christmas. You've got the opportunity.
Right. This is the 32nd episode of the X series?
Yes.
All right. So let's get real.
This has been
a lot of work. If you appreciate DJ's work, please consider contributing or become a subscriber.
It's a better way. It gives it kind of what happens is we develop a kind of a stronger relationship doing this work. So get behind it any way you can. And certainly go to the website, darkjournalist.com, become a subscriber, sign up for the newsletter. And we are going to deliver some major fireworks for you in November. So with guests like Catherine Austin Fitz, Joseph Farrell, and Richard Dolan, and some other surprises, of course. I haven't forgotten our ex-witness, and we are working on bringing that forward. I can predict very accurately we're going to have her on in November. So
right, and we are also very open to show ideas. So if you want to email us at info@darkjournalist.com with interesting testimony or show ideas,
it's incredible feedback that we've been getting on the work that we're doing. And I can tell you, I'm so impressed with the level of interaction that we have going. We've really developed something here that I think can be an incredible platform for getting into really deep, rich material and understanding. The X Steganography series brings forward things that relate to the mystery schools on one end and to the government secrecy programs and the UFO file on the other. And somewhere in between, we're kind of caught right in the middle of that. So it's great to get a handle on it, and so beneficial. Thanks so much for letting me share my work with you. And we will see you on Wednesday.
I'm going to give a cult fan the last word. I'm not going to try to read the Latin, although I did take Latin. It's been a while. Okay. Wine is strong. A king is stronger. Women are stronger still. But truth conquers all.
That's a great one. Wow. I would say per adua ad astra, through difficulty to the stars. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, everyone, for being with us. We will see you next week. And Halloween. Happy Halloween. It's coming up. And have a great night. And Miss Olivia, the only question that's remaining is, what's for dinner?
The rest of my burrito.
Isn't that cheating?
Why? Because it's leftovers? It's got my name on it.
You can do better than that for a Saturday night.
And a shot of tequila.
Someone asked about the time capsule. Boy, are you going to get an update in November. It's coming. We will see you. And here's a little picture for everyone to keep in mind. We'll see you next week.
Good night, everybody.
Burrito.